is Dr. Richard Verone continuing my oral history interview with Andy DeBona. Today is September 12, 2003. It's 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas again, and Mr. DeBona is in Ennis, Montana. Sir, let's pick up where we left off yesterday. You had come back into the United States. You'd taken your 30 days leave, and you're heading off to Quantico, Virginia, to Amphibious Warfare School. Could you describe your transition to Quantico and what went on?
Basically, with the 30 days leave, it left enough time for the family to go on back also. 30 days leave, and I believe there was something like 7 days travel. So we just started packing up and moving on out. Mm-hmm. Spent some time in Pennsylvania with the grandparents, both my wife's parents and my parents, mm-hmm. and then headed down to Quantico.
Okay.
I reported into Quantico. The school did not start until February, so I was put down at an OCS, Officers Candidate School, mm-hmm. as the executive officer of Company B, the same company that I graduated from.
Mm-hmm.
In the latter part of that project, I took through one of the candidate companies at that time. I was then put over in a candidate company where I was the CO,
mm-hmm.
and took another platoon or a candidate company platoon through there,
mm-hmm.
and then it reported to school.
Okay. Let me ask you about commanding this candidate company, and this is exactly similar to what you went through, and I'd asked you earlier if any of your instructors, your DIs, everybody who was training you were Vietnam veterans, or I think at that time were Korean veterans. This time around, you're a war veteran. Did they ask you about your experiences, and if so, did you talk about them?
There was no asking in a candidate company.
Okay.
The candidates, per se, were the college boys that I had seen before. There was no reason to ask because of what was worn on the shirt. The have been there, done that type ribbons,
mm-hmm.
Particularly with when one had a Purple Heart. And all of my staff NCOs and officers, I would have one lieutenant or captain with the platoon, and there were four platoons in the company, and all the staff NCOs. In fact, I ran into one of my staff NCOs that served me with me in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did you enjoy leading the candidate company?
It was fun. I always enjoyed being around Marines or future Marines or whatever. It was interesting to see my perception as the commanding officer,
mm-hmm.
or the XO of the company as opposed to going through the company. So I figured I knew most of the tricks, particularly with my devious enlisted service that I had before.
Yes, sir. Tell me about transitioning into Amphibious Warfare School. How long was this school supposed to last, and what was it like?
The school was a cut-down version, and we had just started. It was supposed to have a mix of aviators and other branches, the branches being infantry and supply and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
However, at that time, the turnaround time for aviators to go back to Vietnam was 2 years. So, consequently, it was very difficult to get a component of aviators in there, whether they be helicopter or fast movers. So we had few aviators. Generally, the people going to that school at that time had either just come back from Vietnam or their next tour, or their next tour of duty was going back to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the only type of Marines that were there.
Okay. How long was the school supposed to last?
School was 5 months.
Okay. And we're into 1968.
That's correct.
Let me ask you a question about what's going on here in the United States, the home front in 68 and then into 69. Tell me about your impressions of the anti-war movement and the growing discord with what the government was doing in Southeast Asia. What were your impressions?
I was sort of away from all that because we lived on the military base.
Mm-hmm.
We shopped on the military base. We very rarely got off the military base. So as far as an anti-war movement, there was nothing there at Quantico then in 68, because the early 68, the movement had not really picked up that much steam. It
mm-hmm.
was going pretty well, if my memory serves me correctly, but it wasn't until after the Tet period that, in my opinion, it started picking up more.
Yes.
So while going to school, it was just strictly a school type, and the object of the school is to train for the next higher level, either a battalion staff level or a battalion commander level.
Okay.
And also to impart tactics, albeit the tactics that they were teaching were Korean War and World War II tactics.
Okay. Did you have a sense then when these tactics were being taught to you that these were inadequate for what was happening at the present time?
I voiced my displeasure in any number of times personally to the instructors and also in class. And consequently, there were times when during the periods that another classmate and myself or just myself would go up and say, hey, that's the school solution, but this is how you really do it.
What was their response?
Extremely well from the students. I don't think the instructors liked it all that well. But it was a give-and-take type thing with the instructors. They were all Marines, primarily majors. We did have a few captains. In fact, the guy that caught artillery there was with our BLT, a guy by the name of Tom Brackman,
mm-hmm.
who taught the artillery class there. But they were all receptive to it. Whether they liked it or not, I can't say.
Okay. You told me that before you left Vietnam, you wrote a report on what I learned in Vietnam.
That's correct.
And did you take these ideas home with you, and was this part of what you were suggesting to the folks at Quantico and the warfare school? And
Yes, exactly. This is what I did also at this place, Richard. I went to my advisor, what we call the schoolhouse advisor, or our den daddy,
mm-hmm.
And gave him that copy of that list, and I said, hey, you know, I would like to publish this and give it to all the students, particularly those who were returning to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
which I did.
Oh, so they were receptive to that?
Very much so.
Okay. Can you relate to me what you had in that paper, what you did learn in Vietnam that first tour?
Boy. Yeah, I went through the different areas in Vietnam, the ones that I had operated in. And the further south we had ever been was in Phu Bai, so I couldn't speak to the Chu Lai area or the Arizona Territory or
mm-hmm.
any of the other places where the 1st Marine Division was then located.
Mm-hmm.
But I primarily covered the tactics that we used, how you can find out where the mortars are, where you put in your mortars, where you plan your H&I fires. Never go out on a patrol unless you have pre-planned artillery along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get up to the DMZ, dig deep. I could probably find it somewhere. I don't know if I have a copy left. It's probably mm-hmm. about a 7-page document
mm-hmm.
Typed, but it covered any number of things, logistics, water, how much ammo to carry, and things of that nature.
How long was it?
It was about 7 pages, seven
okay.
or eight.
Okay. Can you tell me some specific examples of what they did teach you at Amphibious Warfare School?
They taught us the chain of command, the level at the regiment,
mm-hmm.
and how the regiment would fit into amphibious task grouping, for instance, amphibious warfare, the doctrine of amphibious warfare,
mm-hmm.
Tactics, of course. There were discussion groups on different types and how to make a night attack, tactics,
mm-hmm.
The capabilities and limitations of each of the supporting units, so you knew what they could do for you. It was quite an extensive school.
Okay. Did you feel like you got a lot out of that, or was it not what you expected?
The primary thing I got out of it, I met people there that I ran into my whole career in the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the backdoor network or the good boy network or whatever, but that was the biggest thing I got out of that school. The ability to meet other people from other areas of expertise through supply, motor transport, like I say, no air wing, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So then later in the career, who's the guy that's in charge of this? Oh, he's at headquarters of Marine Corps. Well, what's his name? And in some cases, I would personally know the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So that aspect, what I always thought was the most redeeming quality of the school, yes, the knowledge was there, but the interaction between the students and instructors was the primary thing that I got out of it.
Okay. When you graduated, where did you go?
Well, the excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
My monitor at the Marine Corps career pattern at that time is after school, it is at independent duty.
Mm-hmm.
So independent duty, I was just scheduled to go to the be the CO of the INI staff in Wheeling, West Virginia, mm-hmm. which is close to my hometown, which is this is my independent duty.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was that Quantico at that time had picked up a number of things, so I was sent back down to OCS to take through, I think the quote was, one of the candidate companies one time, and then I was going to go.
Okay.
And I graduated in June, and that was about a 10-11 week transition by the time you pick up a company
mm-hmm.
and then graduate them and then move out. Of course, now this would be not advantageous from the aspect of the children who are enrolled in school. That means that I would have to pull them out, but I'm a Marine and I do what I'm told.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get out of there until December of that year. And the one turned into two, the two turned into three, and eventually I went over and said, hey, you know, I'm not supposed to be doing this. I was here for one time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's about time. By that time, the Wheeling, West Virginia INI staff job had been filled. So then the next thing that came up was the recruiting officer in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the 4th District that stretched from Lima, Ohio, down to Kentucky, which included Columbus and all the small towns in between.
Mm-hmm.
But Cincinnati was, in fact, the headquarters for RS Cincinnati.
When did you go up there? What year?
I got there in December of 69.
Okay.
And I actually took over because we had a turnover period in January of 70.
Okay. And how long were you there recruiting?
I was there on a 3-year tour. I was there 2 years and 8 days.
Okay. Okay.
And that was a reason for that.
Okay. Well, tell me about your experiences in Cincinnati. Now, the anti-war movement is now in full swing.
Oh, the anti-war movement is now in full swing.
Right. Tell me about Cincinnati.
Cincinnati is a very patriotic type town.
Mm-hmm.
Had never had any trouble there with wearing the uniform. In fact, wore the uniform every day, as did my recruiters in the outlying areas.
Mm-hmm.
And the Marine Corps, my experience at least there, the Marine Corps was not a target of the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm.
The primary target was the Army because of the draft.
Okay.
I had gotten on, in fact, I had even gotten on a couple of radio stations at the Antioch College, which is a hotbed of military or anti-war movement, and had a couple of radio debates there.
Oh, yeah?
And I felt that I acquitted myself quite well, because the kids called in, of course, with their rhetoric. Anti-war rhetoric is completely, and I said, oh, geez, that's nice, except that doesn't apply to the Marine Corps. Tell me something that does.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things did you see going on in the city itself as far as anti-war demonstrations?
In the city itself, little, if any.
Okay.
I never saw a demonstration. We were in the federal building,
mm-hmm.
Which is where the recruiting headquarters was located. And even when I got out in the road, I used to go out in the road at least once a month to visit all my substations. And I had 7 of them spread throughout the state of Ohio. And never had any, when I'd go there, ask the recruiters if they were having any troubles. Nope. And the main thing was that it was just getting in bodies, and
mm-hmm.
we shipped 117% of quota.
Wow. So you didn't have any trouble really obtaining Marines.
Oh, well, let me back that up.
Okay.
There was a standard that I attempted to put into place in that the guy that I relieved said, hey, you know, the guys who really make it well are the high school graduates.
Mm-hmm.
So I attempted to have the high school graduates in the category on the test they take that used to be called the AFES, the Armed Forces Induction Station, and I don't know what they call it now, but that gave them a mental rating, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And it went from 1 to 4, and in 4 there was category 4A, 4B, and 4C. I attempted to try to get at least category 3 and above. I was given a quota for the 4s and below, primarily because of McNamara's 100,000, and where he was going to use the military as the training ground for the people who weren't quite as educated or couldn't pass tests, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Andy, let me interrupt you just for a moment. I need to pause and change out this disc.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Getting on. Our quotas at this time during the winter months, so to speak, will probably be, and this is strictly from memory, but it's close, probably 135, 140 recruits per month mm-hmm. during that period of time. During the summer months when the high schools had graduated, our quotas were somewhere around 250.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, didn't have any trouble filling those, but what would happen was may have the district, and the district had a number of stations in it, including the Philadelphia area,
mm-hmm.
RS Philadelphia, who would continually, a large area, large quota, but they would continually fall off. So every month I would have to ship extra people. And how we'd ship them is one of two ways. One, we'd have our Cat 4s. And our Cat 4s, we had numerous Cat 4s, more than we needed. So I'd ask the district director, well, you know, I can give you bodies, but they're not going to be Cat 1s, Cat 2s, and Cat 3s. He said, well, I need bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'd ship. I mean, some of these people I would not have in my Marine Corps, which basically is why I spent 2 years and 10 days, whatever it was, on a three-year tour.
Right.
That's later.
Your standards are too high?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
We made quota every month. We overshipped every month. And we were the stellar RS in the district, every dog and pony shows. All the generals would come out to visit. They'd take them down to Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had a dog and pony show that wouldn't quit. Charts, graphs,
mm-hmm.
And the whole bit.
What kind of Marine were you looking for to go to Vietnam?
Well, that is the point. You know, they're joining the Marine Corps. They're not going to Vietnam.
Okay.
However, we have what we'd call shipping days when we'd ship our recruits or our candidates for being Marines out. And every time that we'd have one of those, I'd go into the thing prior to them shipping out, prior to them swearing in officially, and I said, there is a 99.9% chance that you are going to go to Vietnam and you're going to get shot at. And I want you to know right now that that's where you're probably going to go and you're probably going to get shot at.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you don't want to join the Marine Corps, I'd advise you to walk out right now. Mm. And it never happened.
It never happened.
Never happened.
Wow.
And I don't know, and I attribute that to the job that the recruiters did.
Mm-hmm.
I had some outstanding people out there. I, of course, the typical bell curve, I had a few of them that I had to relieve.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of them were outstanding Marines. I know I got away from the question. What was the question?
Well, the question was, no, that's perfectly fine what you said. It's very interesting. And so when your recruiters are looking at these Marines, what kind of qualities did you tell them to look for, and what personally did you feel would make a good Marine in 1969, 70, 71?
When I initially looked at my recruiters, I'd say, this is the type of Marine I want. I want them to be a Cat 3 or above, preferably a high school graduate. That was, and then eventually it came when I kept getting hit with overshipments, and we'd have what was called a pool also.
Mm-hmm.
The pool being that, we have our quotas made for this month, so you're going to be shipped out on whatever date. We tell all the people that enlisted the date they're going to go.
Mm-hmm.
When the overship would hit, I'd have to juggle my pool. In other words, I might have 60% of my people ready for next month, and then they had to go out. And so what it basically came down to, when I told my recruiters, when the call comes in for Cat 4s, the call comes in for an overship, you better have some bodies ready, and I don't care what kind they are, because that was the instructions that I received from district.
Mm. Was that frustrating for you?
It was very difficult looking in the mirror. Yes. And once again, this is why I requested to get out of there to go back to Vietnam.
Okay, so you actually requested an early ending to that tour.
Yes.
To go back into the war.
Well, it was when I called up my monitor, I asked him where I was going next. I had made major then, as soon as, in fact, probably a week after I'd been selected for major, because it is major's bulletin, probably about a week after reporting into Cincinnati, I was promoted to major.
Mm-hmm.
And I called up my monitor periodically to say, hey, how are things going? Where does it look like I'm gone? He said, well, you're going to 3rd MARDIV. I said, 3rd MARDIV? He said, aren't the Marines getting out of Vietnam? And this was, late 70, about mid-71.
Mm-hmm.
He said, yeah. I said, isn't there any place else I can go? He said, well, you're due for an overseas, because your rotation tour date is such that you have to go back over.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what else is there? He said, well, there's a Marine Advisor School that you can go to. So I did a little checking on the Marine Advisor School, and that had started in February of 71.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, it would once again, killing two birds with one stone,
mm-hmm.
I could get out from something that I didn't really I enjoyed doing it because of my recruiters and the Marines that I met there.
Mm-hmm.
I did not enjoy doing it by virtue of the fact of the people that I was putting in the Marine Corps.
Yes, sir. And where was Marine Advisor School?
Marine Advisor School was back in Quantico.
Okay.
And we were the last Marine Advisor School because that aspect of Vietnamization now was coming in, and they envisioned this to be the last class going through.
Okay. How long was this school going to last?
School lasted a period of February, March, April, 10 weeks.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about what they taught you and everything?
Primarily, about half of it was Vietnamese language.
Okay.
The other half was current conditions. What they would do is they would have the old advisors who would, in Quantico being the crossroads of the Marine Corps, there was never a shortage of them.
Mm-hmm.
They would have them come in and talk to the class about their experiences as advisors. We got supporting arms, which I knew fairly well. In fact, I knew supporting arms probably better than anyone else, as far as artillery and air and naval gunfire and things of this nature. And so basically it was about 50% language and about 50% tactics of what to do.
How much do they tell you about Vietnam itself, the culture, how to deal with Vietnamization, how to actually advise?
Well, their instructions were, you know, there were a couple of no-nos, that you would never do this, you never do that, you know, and just basically it was common sense.
Okay.
Because as a senior advisor, the majors and above in the class were going to be going with the battalion commander,
mm-hmm.
who in some cases had been fighting for 10 or 12 years, and the captains or the junior advisors would be going with the battalion executive officer.
Mm-hmm.
Or with the Bravo Command Group, which is the way the Vietnamese Marines worked.
Okay. Did your family stay in Cincinnati while you went to Quantico?
Cincinnati, family stayed in Cincinnati, and what I used to do, because it was a TAD thing, I used to fly home every weekend.
Okay. How did your wife feel about, and the rest of your family, feel about you going back to Vietnam?
Well, I was going back to Vietnam in a period in time that the old advisors coming in, the Vietnamese Marines at that time were in Four Corps,
mm-hmm.
Which was down near Saigon in the Rungsat area, and the word coming back was it was the best thing in the world. You get to see a different part of Vietnam, shrimp the size of your big toe. Very rarely, if ever, you'd make a contact. You'd be billeted with the Vietnamese Marines the whole time with the battalion commander. He'd be staked out in his villa somewhere as his headquarters.
Was that what happened?
No, that isn't. In March, prior to our graduation from the advisory class, the Vietnamese Marines were assigned to Northern I Corps.
Oh, boy. Okay. So that changes everything.
Well, yes, it does for me, but I never let my wife and family knew that.
Oh, really? They thought you were still in Four Corps.
Oh, yes. We were going to be in Four Corps where, you know, the only thing you had to worry about was how many shrimp you were going to have for dinner tonight.
Mm. So you were really trying to protect them.
Oh, had to.
Okay. Did you keep up with the war? Well, I'm sure you did, but how much did you keep up with the war while you were home between these two tours?
Of course, I read the paper. Mm-hmm. I read the newspaper articles, which were extremely slanted.
Mm-hmm.
I felt as with anti-war bias, the tactical situation over there. I knew about Tet. I knew that we had just cleaned our clocks during Tet, but the way the media was reporting it, it was the worst defeat we ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that after Tet, the Vietnamese, particularly the VC, ceased to be an effective fighting force because the NVA, you know, they were the ones that got creamed.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the NVA got creamed too, but they pretty well took care of the cadre of the Viet Cong and also the Viet Cong fighting forces.
Mm-hmm.
I figured this is even a better reason to go down there to Four Corps.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hey, you know, if they made one contact a month now, we're probably going to see one every other month.
Right.
But to answer your question, at a strategic level, or a tactical level, I was not that well-versed. I figured the situation, when I got there, the situation in the terrain would change.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, I was happy that we were going back to Northern I Corps because I knew that area.
Right.
I had gone just about everywhere there.
Right. What did you think of the Vietnamization policy itself?
The policy itself was probably well thought out but poorly executed. The poor execution came from the fact that there were the monies that came pouring in, the supplies that came pouring in. Once they reached the hands of the Vietnamese, there was no more accountability.
Hmm.
Now, this didn't happen that much with the Vietnamese Marines, but it still did.
Mm-hmm.
There was just an endless supply. Whatever the Vietnamese, in a sense, would need, boom, they would have in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you think the South Vietnamese were capable themselves of defending their country without any foreign assistance?
Yes, in one sense, yes, in one sense, no.
Okay.
The biggest thing they had to develop, of course, was an air force or air power, because this is the Marine concept. The Marine, if you will, division does have its own air wing.
Mm-hmm.
It has its own support there. The Vietnamese Marines never had that.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they tried to, in a sense, mirror image U.S. Marines, without the air, without the other logistical capabilities, for instance, they didn't have tanks.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have Amtraks until later on. They eventually did get a platoon of Amtraks in there, but that was later, and that pretty well fell into disuse because of the maintenance problems with them.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what they were was light infantry, and any time light infantry goes up against a mechanized attack like the North Vietnamese had, no doubt who's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
So did I think that they could ever do it without U.S. help? Not the way they were structured at that time.
Okay.
Eventually, if in fact they had the time, the money, and the training, and I can speak strictly from the Vietnamese Marine aspect or mm-hmm. side, they were tigers. As far as the Arvin went, I would not call them a fighting force, at least in I Corps.
How much contact did you have with Arvin?
We very rarely had the contact with the Arvin since I was with the Vietnamese Marines the whole time. I ate with them, slept with them, did everything with them,
mm-hmm.
Walked with them, where they went, I went. The Arvin, on the other hand, we'd very rarely see them because we'd be out on fire support bases. However, when we'd make a motorized march or something like that, it seemed like everybody in the world in the local towns had on a uniform but weren't doing anything and had no weapon with them.
Hmm. How did that affect the morale of your Marines?
No.
Okay.
No, the Marines, there's a caveat here. The Marines were mostly recruited from around the Saigon area,
mm-hmm.
so this was home to them.
Okay.
The Arvin, for instance, the 3rd Arvin Division, which they formed in Northern I Corps that fell apart during the Easter Offensive, they were recruited from the villages and hamlets in that area in northern I-Corps. Mm-hmm. So their primary concern when they when the NVA came rolling across was for their family. Mm-hmm. While the Vietnamese Marines' families were in Saigon, and so it was a whole different thing, mm-hmm. a whole different aspect.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and talk about you coming back into country. Where did you fly into?
I flew into Saigon.
Okay. And this is in June 71?
I came in on 10 June 1971.
Okay. How did it feel coming back into Vietnam? What were your first impressions?
Smell and heat.
Okay. How long were you in Saigon?
Well, the thing was, when I landed in the 10th of June, I went over to the Bo Tu Linh, which was the Marine Division, Vietnamese Marine and American Advisor Headquarters, mm-hmm. Reported in there. So the next morning they said, hey, you're going to relieve Major Sweeney, who's going home with the 4th Battalion. So you're going to be the senior advisor there.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see you tomorrow morning. So went out that night, partied, found out, got a hold of Major Sweeney, talked to him all about the 4th Battalion, and they were going to be in Saigon for 3 months because they had just come back from I-Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And their normal rotation policy was 3 months in the up there, 3 months back because of the 9 infantry divisions. And there wasn't that much call for them, so they came back to retrain, refit. I said, mm-hmm. geez, 3 months in Saigon? Now, this is definitely a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
The 11th, I went out and met the battalion commander, said hello. My name's DeBona, Tieta DeBona, and he spoke very good English, mm-hmm. as did the XO. I was assigned my radio man, who was also an English-speaking enlisted Marine, and got back in that evening. And I got a call to report over to the Bo Tu Linh, which were the headquarters. Mm-hmm. I went over to the Bo Tu Linh and said, and here we go again. I reported in early out of my class,
mm-hmm.
just to make sure that I would get a battalion.
Okay.
Remember I relayed that before about getting a company?
Yes, sir.
Well, this time it worked. I'm getting a battalion because I don't want to be in the rear somewhere mm-hmm. With the gear doing something else. So I had the 4th Battalion, very happy about that. Knew I was going to be there a while. I got a call that the evening of the 11th. This is my second day in country now.
Mm-hmm.
And said, guess what? You're going north to be the senior advisor for the 7th Battalion. I said, oh? He said, yeah, the senior advisor just got killed there, and we need a senior advisor, and you're the only one around.
Wow.
That evening, after getting my gear packed and everything else, I took off and I joined the 7th Battalion on the 12th of June.
Okay. Where were they located exactly?
Well, where they were exactly, I have the grid coordinates, but it was also a place called Dong Cha Mountain.
Okay.
The battalion at this time had gone in to check out the effects of a B-52 strikes.
Okay.
And the effects of the B-52 strikes, it was just like disturbing an anthill, in that the battalion at that time was completely surrounded, taking heavy casualties. In fact, when I landed in the zone, the body of the guy I was replaced, Captain Mike Dickey,
mm-hmm.
Was put on the bird. Mm-hmm. We were taking incoming mortars at the time, and not only did Captain Dickey get on the bird, but the junior advisor had been wounded that I knew nothing about, and he got on the bird.
Mm-hmm.
So they lifted off, and there I am on the 12th of June, my second day in country, or third day, looking around, and what is this? And I thought, it's sort of a continuation of, didn't I just leave this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's you said you were surrounded.
Oh, yes.
So
oh, yeah.
You're right back into a very bad situation.
Very bad situation. In fact, it was made even worse by the fact that the battalion commander at that time, Lieutenant Colonel Nha, had medevaced himself for a snake bite.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Lieutenant Colonel Vinh in there who had been in command all of one day and didn't know any of his people. He was the regimental XO, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And when Nha evacuated himself, he went out there to take over command of the battalion.
Okay.
As in effect, it was not a good place to be and not a good place to be at.
Mm-hmm. What did you do first?
Well, the first thing I did was find out where my hole was, or a hole was, because they were still hitting us with mortars.
Mm-hmm.
I did pick up my radio operator. Now that I had a radio operator, I was able to communicate. We got in the Army from gunships, got in touch with the Army gunships. We had two of them at a time and sometimes four. Started having them make runs on the suspected and also enemy positions, and it was a busy day.
Mm-hmm. How many Americans did you have with you?
Me.
That's what I thought. Okay. How did that feel? Did you feel alone?
That's probably an understatement. Mm-hmm. Particularly just thrust into that situation at that time, not knowing the battalion commander, not having any time to make an assessment of the fighting capabilities of the individual Vietnamese Marines.
Right.
It was definitely a not a happy time in my mind. But the thing was, that I knew that we had as long as I had close air support, I could keep the bad guys somewhat away from us.
How was your supporting arms support in general, both tours?
I never had as many gunships in my life as I had in my second tour.
Okay.
In fact, later after this was over, the Army guys, who we immediately, obviously, established a great rapport with, who are flying out of Camp Evans,
mm-hmm.
every time they were airborne, they would check into my net because they would have said, hey, you got anything for us?
Mm-hmm.
And inevitably, I would have something for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a great thing as far as the gunship support went.
Okay.
Fast movers, if we had to have fast movers in really a bad situation, yes. Army artillery, located at Camp Carroll, they had 8-inch and 175s.
Mm-hmm.
175s were not that accurate. You might be able to get two rounds in the same grid square. But the 8-inch, I used them one time for a destruct mission when I moved them 10 meters at a time
mm-hmm.
to take care of a recoilless rifle that was shooting at us that I was unhappy about.
Hmm. How many Vietnamese Marines, were you commanding when you landed?
I didn't command any. Remember,
You're advising.
I'm advising.
How many then were serving under the commander?
We had about 450.
Okay.
Now that was the TO strength when they went in there.
Mm-hmm.
However, and let me check through my notes here, and I think I have a casualty figures in here. When we eventually got out, and getting out was another story.
Mm-hmm.
Just give me a second.
Sure.
Oh, here we go. Okay, we had out of that 450, we had 22 Ks. 15 missing, and 216 wounded.
Wow. Can you tell me... Go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
Well, can you tell me what happened, the progress of the battle there, and how you did get out?
They decided now, since we had figured out the strike of the B-52,
mm-hmm.
didn't go where it should have gone, they tried to... Then the next word was, well, you got to get out of there,
mm-hmm.
which was a no-brainer. We started trying any landing zone or any cleared area that we moved to, the NVA were there already.
Okay.
And so it came down to a point, and by this time I had no secure radio gear
mm-hmm.
with me, and we always talked on the KY-38 secure radio. So it came down to the point I said, well, we're going to have to blow our own LZ.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a hill called 410. And so I called up the advisor net back at regiment, and I said, hey, we need the smallest shotgun taken apart, the smallest gauge shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
Short story long, Air Force ran about at least 10 sorties into this hill
mm-hmm.
and just blew the whole top of it apart. And this then became our landing zone. The interesting thing was, we went up there to Hill 410, which was completely tree-covered before,
mm-hmm.
and now we had blown it into probably about a 2-3 bird LZ. We found 25 bodies of the bad guys.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
That I felt was rather ironic, and I don't know what they were doing there. I don't really care what they were doing there.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we started the helolift. It didn't take long for the bad guys to get their mortars back into range again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I rolled over this one tree that was up there, blown down, landed smack on an ant's nest.
Mm.
And these were the type of ants that bit. So it came down to their personal choice. Do I want to get bitten by ants, or am I going to move out of here and take a chance with the mortars?
Mm-hmm.
And I moved.
Okay.
Then I talked to the battalion XO, because the battalion commander, the first bird that landed,
mm-hmm.
the very first bird that landed, the battalion commander got on it
mm-hmm.
and left.
Okay.
Before his wounded, before anybody.
Okay.
And so he's gone. So now it's me, and by this time they had lifted in another junior advisor,
mm-hmm.
Dave Randall. And he, hypothetically, was to talk to the XO.
Mm-hmm.
So the next bird that came in, we're going to evacuate the wounded, and that's the way it's going to go. However, the next bird that came in, there was a break in discipline, and the able-bodied that started rushing towards the helicopters, hanging on to skids, things of that nature. And so I went over there and physically removed them, told the bird to take off with the wounded it had aboard, but not the able-bodied. Went to the XO and said, hey, this lift is going to stop right now unless you can get your Marines under control.
And what happened?
And he did.
He did?
Oh, yes.
Sounds like you had some discipline to deal with.
Yes. Well, it was these kids, and I'm, you know, I call them kids. They're Vietnamese Marines, 18, 19 years old, and when the shit really hit the fan like that, I don't know whether this was the first battle. Both of them, this was the first big battle they were in.
Mm-hmm.
They had come off of Lamps on 719,
mm-hmm.
where the 7th Battalion was pretty well destroyed, as were most Vietnamese Marine battalions in Laos at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But they had refitted, retrained, and now they're going back.
Okay.
So this was the most, for the most part, the first big battle that they had seen.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, the XO got the discipline out, discipline finally. We were able to get out almost all the wounded, because it was only a 2 or 3 bird LZ,
mm-hmm.
and it was hot in that they were continually taking mortar fire in it.
Mm-hmm.
But those Army aviators, they came in there. It was just phenomenal. They'd come in and land not worried about the mortar shells bursting around them. And I had gunships up there looking for them, but... harder to find mortars, but at least it wasn't artillery.
Right.
Make short story long, we did get out of there on the, let's see, 19th, we eventually got out of there. That was the day of the hell lift. They moved the battalion, 7th Battalion, back to Camp Carroll,
mm-hmm.
and talked about that. Their fighting capabilities were about zilch with all the casualties they had. So then it was decided we went down to Miloc for a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
Then we moved down to refit and retrain down eventually on the 28th of July. Oh, no, crush it, 16th of July.
Mm-hmm.
We moved south down to Van Kep, which was the Vietnamese Army training camp,
mm-hmm.
in close proximity to the Aussies who were there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to ask you about that. How much did you work with or see Australian, New Zealanders, or ROC troops?
When we were down in Van Kep from the period of 28 July to 29 August, I was invited over to their mess because you probably don't remember it, but I have an article saying the last U.S. Marine leaves country, shows a picture of him on 20 July of 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was sort of a novelty, and that by this time I had gotten back Captain Rice, too. He had recovered from his wound,
mm-hmm.
his shrapnel wound. And so we were sort of an oddity, and you know, they would take me on down there, give me their briefings of what was happening. We were not in a tactical sense, per se, but if they needed us, we could have probably gone out and done something.
Mm-hmm.
So they give me a rundown of their AO, the contacts they had made, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the Aussies?
Great people.
Yeah?
Great people. I mean, they had some of the equipment, particularly their packs, that I wish we would have had. And I did pick up one of their packs.
What did they have that you wanted that you didn't have?
There was a larger pack than the standard issue. Had more pockets in it. You could carry more.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the lessons I learned from this, too, was water, particularly in that initial thing. And I normally carried two canteens,
mm-hmm.
thinking that was enough. When I was in charge of the company, that was enough because I'd always plan my my movement.
Right.
And we would go ahead and cross the stream. When I was with the battalion, however, trying to evade the NVA, we'd very rarely cross the stream,
mm-hmm.
and we wouldn't keep to the low ground. So one of the things I learned, I then had a quart bottle plus the two canteens.
Hmm. Okay, and that was adequate?
Yes,
okay.
That was adequate.
Okay. Tell me about
because
the
because it rained, and I would collect rainwater also
mm-hmm.
in my canteens.
Okay. Tell me about the training that you put your battalion through, or you advised the commander to put the battalion through at Van Kemp.
It was primarily support the organic weapons. The organic weapons, by that I mean mortars. The infantry battalion, Vietnamese infantry battalion, also had a recoilless rifle section, which were 57s. They would never carry them. And so, consequently, they would not do that much training in that.
Mm-hmm.
This training aspect was mostly for the platoon commanders, the reconstituted battalion, if you will, to get together, discuss tactics. It was modeled after a U.S. Army-type training thing, which was adequate and which was good.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing was, just to keep them out there, get them to know each other,
mm-hmm.
and feel the Vietnamese Marines to feel comfortable with each other again.
How did you find the Vietnamese fighters and the Marines that you were advising? Were they stereotypical, or were they a cut above? And I know you've mentioned that they were tigers, but...
defensively, very few offensive operations that we go on. We're mostly in a defensive-type position,
mm-hmm.
and if you would attack them in a defensive-type position, they would not run, they would stay there, they would literally fight to the last man.
Mm-hmm.
In an offensive situation, we were never, during my whole tour there, never did we conduct a sweep operation with the battalion.
Hmm.
Never did we go anywhere outside of our fire support bases, except maybe 200 to 300 meters outside to set up ambushes outside of those. But offensively, it just didn't happen. And that was sort of after this... the big battle up there in June,
mm-hmm.
It was rarely that we see the bad guys.
Why do you think that was?
They were probably getting ready to stockpiling things. They had moved the Marines out of Northern I Corps. They had put in a force probably about 50% of what was there before.
Mm-hmm.
So the bad guys were probably stacking up their supplies, getting ready for this Easter offensive that they had planned, I'm sure, a long time in advance.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have, as they rolled south, they would just be able to pick up these supplies along the way,
right,
and just keep rolling.
Right. Tell me about the relationship you had with the gentleman you were advising.
Lieutenant Colonel Nha got relieved, and a major by the name of Wei came in. And an interesting individual in that he had been thrown out of the country since he supported the old dictator back when.
Mm-hmm.
He was allowed back in the country. At that time I was, 36, 35,
mm-hmm.
and he was probably in his 40s. He was a major, just got in command of the battalion. And he spoke fluent French, which I didn't speak.
Mm-hmm.
His English was not that good, but always had an interpreter with us. And my Vietnamese was not that good, but we could communicate. It was a, I would say, mutual respect type thing.
Okay. How about the other Marines in general? How did they treat you? How did they act around you?
The enlisted Marines, I had few, if any, contacts with them at the platoon level.
Mm-hmm.
My contacts were primarily with the S3, the operations officer, the battalion commander, my radio operator, and my bodyguard. I had one radio operator who spoke fluent English, and my bodyguard or my cowboy, if you will, make sure that no harm would come to me. Or that was his primary mission, to protect the Kovan. And that's what we were called, Kovan, trusted friends.
Right. Tell me about the bodyguard. What would he do? Would he just shadow you everywhere you went?
Yeah, he shadowed me. He kept his weapon at the ready, make sure that I wouldn't do anything stupid, or if I did something stupid, he'd be right there beside me.
Mm-hmm. What kind of weapon did he have?
He had an M16.
Okay.
And by that time, the M16, the troubles with the ammunition for the M16 or the chamber had been fixed, so the M16 then was a reliable weapon as opposed to my first tour when the M16 jammed on me all the time.
Right. Tell me about what your uniform was like. What did you carry with you?
This time I did not carry a rifle, simply because I figure if I'm with the battalion commander and if we get overrun, there are going to be enough rifles around to go pick up. I did not wear a flak jacket. I had a helmet. What I try to do is, since I was advising the battalion commander, I couldn't go running around with a flak jacket, and he didn't have one. We had our own distinctive uniforms, the tiger stripes with the name tags, Vietnamese and American rank sewed on them. My equipment, as I said, it consisted of about the same thing I had. I'd have, of course, my maps. I'd have my radio codes with me for the KY-38 so that we could talk secure. The radios themselves and the gear themselves were carried by my radio operator, the keying devices. I'd have my air mattress because I'd never go anywhere without my air mattress, thinking my thought was that I'd better have the air mattress, which came in handy any number of times, particularly fording streams in one specific instant when we got pushed out of Mylok later on. But my uniform was basically the same as the first tour. The rations were completely different. What the Vietnamese ate, I ate. We were fortunate at one time to capture a number of NVA flags, and I'd get off of the hill where we were probably about once a week, and when I'd hit the, I'd go off in the morning, come back in the evening, and I'd go around to the different Army installations or Air Force were still around, trading NVA flags for eggs and steak. It's amazing how many you can get for that. So that supplemented our income. I lost quite a bit, our diet, rather. I lost quite a bit of weight as I did the first tour. But the equipment was basically the same. Flashlight, compass, and I had some flares with me. Any number of small little toys, but basically the same equipment.
Okay. Did you feel comfortable?
Initially, no. after I sort of, it was sort of like when the battalion reformed back in Van Kemp. Because I was, I was the tested guy then, because you always, you don't really know how a guy's going to react.
Right.
Until he gets in that position. I was in that position more than probably half the people in the battalion were after we reformed down there. And so I had, in a sense, proven myself. And, after that I did feel comfortable. I felt that if anybody, well, first of all, my own ability. I felt that even if we did get overrun or something like that, I could make it out there. Because I'd have my maps, I had my compass, I had my flares, had a radio, the whole bit. I could do it on my own if I had to. But it was, it wasn't the same as having a Marine rifle company around you, in that you knew the individuals and knew their fighting prowess. It was that you had a battalion of Vietnamese around you, knowing that there are taggers in the defense, but don't know how they would react in the offense.
How much contact with home on the second tour?
Say again?
How much contact with home on the second tour?
Letters. I had, as far as the R&R, I waited. I wanted to wait until later in my tour in the R&R because to take R&R. In fact, my R&R was scheduled for the 10th month I was there, as opposed to the 6th month, which is the normal rotation type thing because of the operational tempo of the battalion, mm-hmm. where they were and when they were due back or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Contact with home, never had a phone call.
Okay.
Of course, letters. Letters kept coming in, and I had a lot of time on the fire support bases to read and to write letters.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the primary thing.
Did you still kind of keep what you were doing in the dark?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Did your kids write you?
Yeah, they did. You know, of course, it was, you know, at that time, they were growing up, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, 16, 17. So they would write, you know, with their high school things that they were going on with
mm-hmm.
them and the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. How much did that boost your spirits, help you?
It helped. Obviously, you know, at this time, the only other Brown Dyer, the only other American during this whole tour while we were in the field, was, of course, was Ron Rice.
Mm-hmm.
But he primarily kept with the Bravo Command Group of the XO.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, I was by myself with the battalion commander. But yeah, I learned to play Vietnamese poker, and quite good at it because
mm-hmm.
I'm quite good at cards, and established a rapport with the Vietnamese, particularly my radio operator and the battalion commander.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it helped to get the letters in. We would not get them in all that often. Probably we'd maybe once to twice a week. We'd have a helicopter land that had the mail
mm-hmm.
that came up from Saigon that would go then to the regimental or the brigade, that they called them, headquarters, and then eventually filter itself out to me.
Mm-hmm. How many letters or how much mail did the Vietnamese Marines get?
Little, if any.
Really?
The primary thing that came in on the helicopters when they would come in would be the supply officer, who was a probably, to me, appeared to be the most ancient first lieutenant in the Vietnamese Marine Corps. He was the supply guy. He'd bring in his two loads of chickens.
Mm-hmm.
They're all tied together, and then their supply system was sort of nothing like that I'd ever experienced before.
Mm-hmm.
The troops would go outside the wire on the fire support bases and get the greens. Their normal ration that they were supplied was rice and a can of fish, like canned tuna.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their normal ration. They would supplement that with the greens outside the wire, the chickens, or sometimes a platoon would bring in some meat. Meat was very rare, with the exception of what the advisor got.
Mm-hmm.
With the steak and egg runs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where did you go after your training at VenCap?
After VenCap, we went back to Saigon for all of from 30 August to 6 September.
Mm-hmm.
Then we moved north again. We landed in My Lac
mm-hmm.
on the 6th to the 9th, and then we went out to Fire Support Base Cates, which is one of the fire support bases out there, overlooking one of the primary avenues of approach into the Northern I Corps there.
Okay. And what was your battalion's main duty?
The main duty was there to report, to stop, to do anything they could to hamper the enemy's ability to move through there in strength to attack not only us, but the other areas to our south.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, this area, this period of time was extremely quiet. We did not make a contact, a ground contact. We never received any mortars. We never received any artillery. We never received any incoming of any type, including small arms fire.
Hmm.
And it was a lull, a definite lull. I mean, mm-hmm. it was amazing.
How long were you there?
We were at Cates from the 10th to the 26th, and then on the 27th to the 30th, 10th to the 26th September,
mm-hmm.
and we moved over to Fire Support Base Holcomb from the 27th of September to the 30th of October.
Okay.
And once again, little of anything. There was nothing coming in there except this was the time. No, that wasn't the time. It was Sarge. That was later.
Mm-hmm.
This was the time that. Correction. This was the time. Okay, this was the time that we had the one recoilless rifle, who had to be the worst shot in the NVA Army. We'd crank off about one or two rounds, and we'd have an artillery battery up there mm-hmm. in position. You crank off one or two rounds, they never hit, but it was a distractor.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when I eventually called in the 8-inch destruct mission on him, and he quit firing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So this was the defensive position in the defensive posture
position.
that you had discussed.
Yes, exactly.
And so they weren't seeking you, the enemy, and you guys weren't out running offensive operations seeking them.
Seeking them, exactly.
Okay.
It was almost like, hey, you know, you don't step on my turf, I'm not going to step on your turf. Let's just be friends.
And you said earlier you thought this was because they were simply just building force for the eventual takeover of South Vietnam.
That was my estimation,
okay,
yes.
Okay. So after Fire Support Base Holcomb, where did you all go?
From Holcomb, we went back again to Mylock.
Mm-hmm.
We were in Mylock from 31 October to 10 December.
Mm-hmm.
And we celebrated the Marine Corps birthday there.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we another advisor to myself, we painted big Marine Corps emblems on the landing pad at Mylock,
mm-hmm.
Because there weren't any more Marines in country. And that was the primary reason we did that, and celebrated the Marine Corps birthday, and then 10 December. From 10 December then until, then we moved back to Saigon from 11 December to 4 January.
Okay. What were your duties in Saigon?
Saigon, it was a totally different area. I mean, it was just like a U.S. city.
Mm-hmm.
Duties in Saigon, a typical day would be get up, our driver would meet Rice and myself out. We'd go out to the battalion base camp. We did not live now with the Vietnamese Marines while they were in garrison,
okay.
Only when they were in the field.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go out there, talk to the battalion advisor, find out what, if anything, they needed, go observe their training with the S3, discuss what was going to be happening next. And the Vietnamese Marines then would be planning their parties because they had successfully come home. So it was a more or less a party peacetime garrison duty.
Okay. What was Saigon like?
Boy, it's no one had weapons. They had the curfew in effect. I mean, it was just a big party town.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, who's having the party tonight type thing. And, of course, the Marines who were there in the rear knew all the, Cords is having a party tonight, or AIDS is having a party tonight, or
mm-hmm.
Let's go here, let's go there. And there was always the Bo Tu Linh where we'd walk into another place down there. They'd always play the Marine hymn at 1900 in the evening,
mm-hmm.
and woe behold the individual who did not stand at attention to the Marine Corps hymn. Or Marine Tim.
Uh-huh.
It was just like peacetime.
Do you want to give me any examples of some of the stuff you all did, or do you want to not do that?
Well, yeah, there wasn't much we did there, except the only thing in the military aspect that we did at that time is, once again, observing training.
Mm-hmm.
Battalion advisors were pretty much on their own in that they were with their advisors. We would go down to the headquarters periodically to or pick up our mail there or anything of that nature, but we were a normal, just a weird source. Each of the field advisors would have an advisor stationed in Saigon
mm-hmm.
as his bunkmate. We had two people to a room. And so when we came back from the field, it was like, first of all, getting the stink and the stench off of us,
mm-hmm.
Getting all our laundry done and things of that nature, making sure our gear was clean. It was, boom, we were out. My advisor at that time was a guy called Jim Brabham, who was a captain, the engineer advisor,
mm-hmm.
A.K.A. Frog Legs. Frog Legs eventually became a three-star general.
Hmm. Okay.
And matter of fact, he called 2 days ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Small corps. But it, that was there wasn't much to do in Saigon. Now, one thing I did not do, there's just something about me that I, and I don't know whether I can say this, you might have to get this out, but I didn't like the women.
Okay.
Over there.
You did not like the Vietnamese women?
I did not. Well, not only Vietnamese, but Okinawan and all.
Really?
And it was a sort of a standing joke that the Kovan, Tia Tha De Bono, would not go with the Vietnamese girls.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, I felt that particularly the battalion commander respected that.
Okay. Did that ever become a problem?
No.
As far as relationships between the senior
officers?
No,
not a bit. In
okay.
fact, my junior advisor, Ron Rice, had a Vietnamese girlfriend or a number, very fluent in Vietnamese, very nice guy, and the whole thing.
Okay.
But it was never, it became an issue.
Okay. So in January, where did you go from Saigon?
We moved back to Charlie 1, which is a bunkered complex. We were there from 5 to the 15th of January. And then we moved over to, on the 16th of January, we moved over to the 4th of February into the Hill of Angels, also called Contien. And this is when things started to become a little bit more like, whoops, guess what, you're back in the war zone.
Right. What happened?
Well, the first round, they had to play zeroed in, obviously.
Right.
The first round of artillery that we had land there, and we were there, probably about 2 or 3 days, landed about 3 feet away from the benchmark.
Wow.
And the benchmark is where the, that is the highest part of the hill. That's where the hill actually peaks. And the bad thing about Contien is they had a super secret army radio relay station there, a radio intercept.
Mm-hmm.
And they had generators going the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So you could not hear the artillery come in.
No.
So you wouldn't know where it was, and I spent most of my time there in a not with the battalion commander, but in a tower there.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 60 feet high, and I would go up there with my glasses, and normally my uniform at that time was a pair of shorts, a soft cover, and my boots, of course, and a book, and binoculars.
Okay.
So I just go up there and look around periodically and just sit up there and read and get a suntan.
Mm-hmm.
The one time I was up there and they did a fire mission, it must have been a training exercise, but the local joke was among the advisors, before they'd move a unit south, the NVA would move a unit south, they had to go ahead and conduct their live fire exercise on one of the fire support bases.
Mm-hmm.
And it was either Sarge in Uibajo or Contien. And one time, there must have been at least 150 mortar rounds come in. No registration round, no nothing, just a boom. The only thing is they hit the wrong hill.
Oh, really?
Thank goodness for that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they landed about 150 meters outside of our lines. Another time, they started shooting rockets at Charlie 1 and at Camp Carroll.
Mm-hmm.
And I had very good observation of the positions, and I had 6 batteries of artillery that I was controlling at that time, putting fires on them. The radio intercept guys, they were not allowed to tell me anything. My first job, the first thing that I did when I got there, I went down and said, hey, if in fact anything ever happens, I will come for you. You will follow me, and we will get out of here if anything ever happens.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of went over really nicely with them.
Mm-hmm.
So periodically, when I was sitting up there in the tower, one of them would stick his head out of the underground bunker and said, Major, you might want to look over there to the northeast and watch out. So he would be able to pick up the fire commands then, and I would be alerted to the fact that the enemy was ready to launch their weapons, and consequently call in fire on them then.
Hmm. Okay. So this incoming, this was the kind of combat that you experienced there at Contien mainly?
Yeah.
Or sold.
Just, no ground assaults, primarily recoilless rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Then they changed the first couple of days when they were firing the rockets at Carol and everybody else. And I guess I'm sure they picked up my radio signals there from Contien. So the third day they decided that wasn't a nice thing to do. So they sort of hit us a little bit.
Mm-hmm. How did you react with the incoming? You know, you've been in some intense combat your first tour. You've been home. You've come back. And the contact you've had has been rather limited. How did you react personally, and was it different from the first time you were there?
One thing I think earlier in this, when I was talking about what was the most feared psychologically was mm-hmm. incoming because you couldn't shoot back.
Yes, sir.
When I first landed over there in June time frame with the battalion over there,
mm-hmm.
We had mortars set up there, and I'd like to harken back to that a second.
Sure.
And the battalion commander, who was a new battalion commander, we had our mortars. They weren't firing or anything else. So I was armed with a .45 then.
Mm-hmm.
So I would take my .45 and I'd point it up in the air and I'd fire off three or four rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd do that again. And eventually the battalion commander saw me doing this. Said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, since you are not firing your mortars, I am now giving them some indirect fire back."
Okay.
So it sort of made the point to him. And at that point in time, then my subtleties, if you want to call that subtle.
Mm-hmm.
The second time up there at Contien, in that period of time when they were shooting at me there, I could see them.
Mm-hmm.
So I would call in the fire on them because of my being 50 meters up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And it got to the point even the Vietnamese Marine artillery guy would come up there with me. But he got hit when he was up there, and I had to carry him down.
Mm. Okay. Did you sense a difference in your personality your second tour?
Yes, and I was more closed, so to speak. Closed in that, and perhaps even more confident than before.
Mm-hmm.
I kept my emotions. Seeing an American Marine get hit was different than seeing a Vietnamese Marine get hit
mm-hmm.
for me. And my personality, per se, I'd always been somewhat facetious and a joker, and I continued that all through the thing.
Okay. Can you expand on what you just said about why it was different, seeing an American Marine versus a Vietnamese Marine killed?
I did not know the Vietnamese Marines personally or by name or, you know, anything like that. They were, as crass as it sounds, they were like, you know, a non-entity.
Mm-hmm.
And it was different than seeing a Marine who I knew his name. I knew a little bit about his family background.
Mm-hmm.
Knew, you know, mother and father, what the effect of that would be on them.
Right.
But it wasn't the same in that respect for me.
Okay. And you were at Contien into February.
Yes, we were the last, I was the last U.S. Marine to leave Contien. We left there on the 4th of February,
mm-hmm.
And then we went back down to where we assigned the mission of Strategic Reserve for Northern I Corps,
mm-hmm.
and we moved down to Da Nang.
Okay.
And we got down to Da Nang on the 5th of February. And Da Nang was another totally different spot than
mm-hmm.
Marine. I had never been that far south
mm-hmm.
in my first tour, with the exception of when we landed, but operationally.
Mm-hmm.
The battalion at this point in time was assigned what I refer to as a postage size AO. And the one battalion was running around in it was about 3 square meters area. And the only good thing to come about that, they ran into a couple booby traps,
mm-hmm.
but they did find a cave full of NVA flags.
Hmm.
And before they went in there, they threw a hand grenade in, which exploded and obviously holed the NVA flags.
Mm-hmm.
The Army people were still there. They were getting ready to pull out. I forget what division or what part of it there. Still there, but anyhow, the Air Force was still there in abundance. So, it was just like gravy train. I would send rice out, or we would both go out during the day while the battalion was there with our hold NVA battle flags, and we'd come back with all sorts of things. Never ate so good. Never ate so good. And my buddy liked Hennessy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would periodically bring him back the Hennessy, and he liked cognac.
Uh-huh.
And so we would get that down there, and it was just like a rear area R&R.
What were your quarters like?
They weren't really quarters. They were a bunker.
Okay.
And had a cot in there, which was always had the cot in the fire support bases. Of course, I had my air mattress with me.
Mm-hmm.
Snoopy, which was the little blanket that that everyone had, the camouflage type blanket. But the quarters were, like I say, just a bunker right next to the battalion commander. In fact, we'd sleep in the same area. He'd be in one end of it, and I'd be on the other.
Okay. How long were you at Da Nang?
We were at Da Nang until the 29th of March.
Okay.
And what happened in the morning of the 29th of March, we were in there playing a game of Vietnamese poker, which I was winning. Rice, Ron Rice, had gone out into town with the trailer and our Jeep at about, about 1000, and to go with the normal eggs and type thing and see how much we could beg, borrow, or steal. Poor Marines, you know, there aren't any Marines here.
Mm-hmm.
What are you guys doing here? Oh, well, you know, we need this, we need that. Oh, and by the way, we have an NVA flag. And at about 10:01, the battalion received an order that we were moving north.
Okay,
we're moving north. Where are we going? Dong Ha. Oh, good. So we're going to go to Dong Ha. When are we flying up? We're not flying up. We're going to go ahead and drive up.
Okay.
Where's the security along the way? We're not going to have any security along the way. What about ambushes on the way? No, we were ordered to get up there. By 2 o'clock, 4 hours later, the battalion was packed, ready to go, which is a monumental feat.
Mm-hmm.
Except Rice was not back yet. So the advisor was not back yet.
And you need him.
Yeah, he's still not knowing. I mean, things like this just don't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we going up there?
Mm-hmm.
And it is the NVA are attacking. Oh, okay. Make short story long, Rice came back about 3:30. The battalion had moved out at 2 in an Arvin truck convoy. And I told my buddy, that means we're going to be driving at night. How are we going to get through all these roadblocks that the local rough puff set up?
Mm-hmm.
We don't worry about that, Tietau. We'll do it.
Okay.
I caught back up. I drove then. Eventually caught up with the battalion, got into our place in the motor march right around the Ivan Pass.
Mm-hmm.
We moved all night, and when we came to the roadblocks, the point lieutenant would get out, talk to the rough puffs in there, and of course we had a whole column of trucks, lights blazing, and I tell you, I was not too happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
Moving at night, no security, anything of this nature.
Right.
We eventually got into Dong Ha, and we got in, not Dong Ha, outside, just outside of Dong Ha. At about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we moved into this place, and I went up to my wife and said, well, where are we going? Well, we're going there. I said, well, why don't we turn off the truck lights? That would probably be a good idea. No, the drivers need to see. So we moved on in, and no sooner did we disembark off of the trucks and the trucks took off that we started receiving incoming artillery.
Wow.
And I said to myself, self, this is not a good place to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is that we're up there. I'm not in contact with any Americans because I don't have their radio freaks.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. All I know is the battalion is there.
Mm-hmm.
So we walked back out of this area where the incoming artillery was. Not all that accurate. It was more or less they saw the trucks, but their spotters weren't that good.
Mm-hmm.
We received no casualties. There were a few close rounds. Walked back out, walked over to the other side of Highway 1 and set into a village over there.
Mm-hmm.
And the orders were the next day at noon, we were going to go reinforce Mylock.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the 30th of March came and went with no vehicles picking us up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still not in contact with any Americans. I have no idea what's happening. Eventually, my buddy tells me through the Vietnamese Marine Net, where he has contact, that this is what's happening. The NVA have started an offensive, and they're coming across the lines. On the 1st of April, apropos April Fool's Day,
mm-hmm.
We started a motor march into Mylock, and the initial word was we were going to ride all the way into Mylock,
mm-hmm.
Disembark there and reinforce Mylock because there was a Marine, the brigade headquarters was there. They had the 4th and the 8th battalions there,
mm-hmm.
but a brigade is normally 3 battalions. We started our motor march. It started out very badly. The vehicle directly in front of me with an Arvin driver tipped over, going over, making the turn at Dong Ha from Highway 1 to Highway 9.
Mm-hmm.
I had bodies all over the place. I crawled under the truck, under the six by,
mm-hmm.
and tried to remove as many as I could. We lost basically a platoon right there.
Wow.
From K's and W's out of that one truck. We continued on down the road, and all of a sudden everybody stops. And we're getting out. And the reason why we're getting out is because we can't go through Cam Lo, because NVA tanks were reported at Cam Lo.
Oh. Okay.
Things are now starting to get a little bit serious, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The report, incidentally, later was erroneous, but that was the report at the time, NVA
mm-hmm.
tanks at Cam Lo.
Mm-hmm.
So then we started a foot march, probably roughly, I would say, 5-6 miles from the turnoff of 9 into Mylock. And as we're going over there, we can see Camp Carroll to the east of us,
mm-hmm.
and there are all kinds of artillery rounds bursting around Camp Carroll. I said, geez, look at that. You know, they must be something happening up there because they're getting a bunch of airbursts. Well,
mm-hmm.
the airbursts were the bad guys' airbursts,
mm-hmm.
not the good guys' airbursts. We eventually got over to Mylock, set in on the other side of the airstrip, not next to the base. I went over, got the radio codes, came on back, and the Bravo command group was generally south of the Bravo with two companies. They were generally south of the airfield, while the Alpha command group with the battalion commander, we were generally to the west of the airstrip,
mm-hmm.
Not separated by more than 300-400 meters.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we're there now in Mylock, and there are artillery rounds landing everywhere in Mylock. I had never seen that intense of a concentration of artillery at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like an old World War I movie is how I like to describe it. When I went over there, all the American advisors were from the brigade were in the bunker, and I remember seeing these old World War I movies where the rounds would land and the sand would come shuffling on down. And one of the people in there was a guy by the name of Tom Ganibus, who was from Homer City, Pennsylvania, which mm-hmm. is not too far from where I was born,
mm-hmm.
who was the artillery advisor. And one of the artillery's claims to fame is artillery led dignity to what would otherwise be a vulgar brawl.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Tom, and I said, Tom, what do you think about the vulgar brawls now? To me, you know, I mean, it was just a surreal type of experience,
mm-hmm.
That this was actually happening.
Right.
At the same time, around the 2nd of April now, the people at the Arvin Regiment, the 57th, I believe it was, at Camp Carroll, surrendered en masse.
Okay.
The American advisor, who was at that time an Army major, through a fluke of fate, came up on the net, in our advisor's net, and said, the Arvin are surrendering. I'm getting out of here. At that same exact moment, fortune would have it, there was an Army helicopter bringing in a resupply of artillery
mm-hmm.
because we had an artillery battery there at Mylok with us, a Vietnamese marine artillery battery.
Mm-hmm.
And they heard his call, went over there and picked him up from sure death or mm-hmm. being a prisoner.
Yes.
And took him back.
Wow.
We're still over in Mylok now with us, and we're getting periodic, and there are mortars firing 300 meters away from us,
mm-hmm.
firing on Mylok. And it's almost like they had a plan, and they did not adapt to the plan about the 7th Battalion coming in there.
Right.
And we would, the only rounds we would ever get, and they were very, very few, would be the overs shooting at Mylok.
Mm-hmm.
We eventually got some ground contact. We wiped out the mortars that were over there. In fact, on the way out, the battalion commander and I and battalion command group, we stumbled right on them.
Hmm.
And so shot them up, got out of there. And eventually the orders were given over the advisor secure net that we were going to, the Vietnamese Marines were going to abandon Mylok because they couldn't be held.
Mm-hmm. Did you realize at the time that you were smack dab in the middle of this Easter offensive?
Say again?
Did you realize you were right in the middle of this major offensive, the Easter offensive?
No, not at all, but I did know, for instance, here I am, I'm getting short again, because now,
right.
This was an 11-month tour the second time. I had now spent a little bit over 10 months in tour.
It seems like it seems like when you're ready to leave, that's when everything starts to heat up.
Exactly. That's my point. Sarge had two companies of the 4th Battalion up there with Walt Boomer, who was later the assistant commandant of the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
They were overrun. They got off. Ray Davis, who was his junior advisor, was on Nui Baho, which was a sort of a adjunct of Sarge. He got overrun. He later made Major General of the Marine Corps. The 8th Battalion over at Holcomb, one of our old bases where we were mm-hmm. for the 7th Battalion, they had two companies up there. They got overrun. And so all the stragglers then started to come through our position or back to Mylok, and eventually where they ended up was Mylok Village.
Right, and then you were ordered to pull back from Mylok?
We were over the advisory net. I got the word that Mylok was going to be abandoned at the beginning of evening nautical twilight, bent.
Mm-hmm.
So I go over to my buddy, and I said, what are our plans to go out of here because Mylok's going to be evacuated? He said, oh, no, they would never do that. They would never evacuate Mylok. I said, Tieta, they're going to go over and evacuate Mylok this evening.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't believe me, even though the rapport that we had established all this time.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually I sat down there and talked to him, and now he started to believe it. He saw the smoke all rising where they were destroying everything that they could destroy in Mylok itself, the combat base. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
The Bravo Command Group in this period of time was also undergoing small probes with enemy infantry. Nothing major, but small, but still, it is one of the most difficult things to do is disengage or start a retrograde movement when part of your unit is engaged.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually the brigade, what was left of the 4th and 8th Battalions, started streaming out of Mylok, and so 7th Battalion mission was to cover the rear of the departing people, make sure nobody caught up with them as they went through to got over there.
Mm-hmm.
This initially started out fairly good, and that the two companies with the command group, the Alpha Command Group, moved on out smartly to Mylok Village. The other two companies with Rice and the XO were still a little bit engaged, but they eventually were able to disengage, and we met over in Mylok Village. The only trouble was the column had already departed with one of our companies.
Mm-hmm.
So now we are a battalion minus. We picked up, never forget, we picked up a French priest. We picked up a Red Cross or a Vietnamese Red Cross worker and a couple of civilians.
Okay.
And so I figured, hey, you know, I'm home free now.
Right.
If we have a priest with us, there's no way.
Right.
Make short story long on this one. It took us 29 hours to move from Mylock with no radio contact with anyone due to the terrain,
mm-hmm.
and also due to the changing frequencies, to go from Mylock straight across country to hit Highway 1.
Mm-hmm.
During this period of time, we crossed and recrossed the same river five times.
Oh, boy.
And the only way we were able to get our wounded, and when we go along there, we'd find other wounded from the other battalions, and the 7th Battalion Marines would pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was left behind.
Okay.
And this terrain, it was brutal. It was so steep in some cases that you actually had to grab onto trees to pull yourself up.
Mm.
How they got the casualties up there, I'll never know.
Mm.
And then going to back down the other side, you slid down in the seat of your trousers.
Mm.
When you came to the stream, and my buddy, instead of finding a fordable spot, what we did, we blew up air mattresses. And those who could swim, swam across. Those who couldn't, and the casualties, we'd ferry them across on our air mattresses.
Okay.
And eventually it came to the point where I went to my buddy, and what he was doing was flying a compass azimuth, not the terrain.
Mm-hmm.
And we were ready to cross the river again. And by that time, I was a little bit irate about the crossing the rivers all the time. I said, hey, you know, we are basically what I said, hey, we're on the south side of the river.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just follow the high ground down there until we get out to the highway,
mm-hmm.
instead of crossing and recrossing this river? My buddy was not a very big man. He was small, even for Vietnamese standards, and
mm-hmm.
he was a little bit older, and I knew he was tired.
Mm-hmm.
And so he followed this advice, and we went. We found a trail and made it out almost in no time.
Okay.
And that's when we got back out on Highway 1. We then went down to I-2, where I saw the advisors down there. The Army advisors had all left.
Mm-hmm.
The only person down there running thing was a lieutenant colonel by the name of Jerry Turley. He has a book out called The Easter Offensive,
mm-hmm.
and it details what happened during this period of time when the world was falling to an end, and the only people up there were Vietnamese Marines and American Marines.
Right. Andy, let's take a break for a moment.
Okay.
Okay, Andy, let me ask you real quick before we continue with this Easter Offensive pullback that you're describing. Did you take an R&R? The second tour?
We were just about to get into that.
Okay. Well, then why don't you continue?
Okay. My R&R date was scheduled when the 7th Battalion was going to be back in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned earlier, normally it's a three-month policy in the north, then pull back to Saigon for the Vietnamese Marine battalions, where they'd go back to their base camps, see their wives, children, whatever.
Yes, sir.
And just sort of slack time for them during that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at my schedule, the 7th Battalion was due to rotate back to Saigon on the 30th of March,
mm-hmm.
and I had my R&R set up for the 10th of April,
okay.
which was getting close to the end of my tour, so I figured gone to Bangkok, the whole thing. When I came walking out of this thing, knowing that my wife was getting ready to go to Bangkok, the first thing I told, one of the first things after getting a new pair of trousers because mine were completely ripped off,
mm-hmm.
told Lieutenant Colonel Turley that R&R was scheduled, but I had to get a hold of my wife to cancel the R&R. He said, no, you can't do that. Colonel, look what's happening here. Yeah, I can do that. He said, no, you might upset her. I said, might upset her? You don't think this stuff is making the papers back in the States about this thing coming across?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but then she would tell the other wives because of the wives network, and they were fairly close, the people who were over here. And so can't have that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And make short story long, I was ordered to go in R&R, which I did on the 10th of April, and returned on the 17th of April.
Okay, so you met your wife in Bangkok.
That's correct.
How did it go?
It went great.
Yeah.
Of course, I didn't mention anything what was happening or
mm-hmm.
what was I going to go back to. In fact, I didn't know what I was going to go back to. I didn't know whether, in fact, the offensive would be rendered or not by that time.
Right.
My way of thinking, I might have gone back, and it's sort of upsetting. and it wasn't not enjoyable in that aspect. It was nice to see her again, and you know, to get out of that type of an environment since I'd put it off for so long.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But my mind never really left, not necessarily, the battalion and Ron Rice.
Right.
Because I knew that things were not that was not a happy time back there.
Right.
Right before I left, though, we had set up into strong defensive positions along the Mechon River.
Mm-hmm.
So the enemy would have to cross that river to get to us, and it was not fordable. And the bridges that we had there, we had them ready to blow.
Mm-hmm.
So in case they did try it with an armor attack, and the only way they could come across was human wave type tactics, and I felt confident we'd be able to, if not at least hold, to repulse their attacks.
Mm-hmm.
The bad feature about that is when we set in prior to going to R&R, we were north of the Mechon. We'd have Arvin on our left and the Rangers on our right, and when we wake up in the morning, we had NVA on our left and NVA on our right until we got down to the Mechon, and that's when the Vietnamese Marines took over the defense of that sector.
Mm-hmm.
Where they were coming down, so there was no question about them deserting their post or deserting that area under fire.
Right.
So we knew then when we went to sleep at night with the Vietnamese Marines on our left and the Vietnamese Marines on our right, when we woke up, they were still there.
Right, right. When you returned from Bangkok, you were obviously almost ready to depart country and go home.
Yes, that's a true story. My rotation tour date then had been established for 10th of May.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it almost seems like, my God, here we are, a repetition of the first tour.
Right.
Why now? So I went back out into the field with the battalion again, and rather a fluky thing happened at this point in time. Ron mm-hmm. and I were sitting in a bomb crater, and all of a sudden he said, "Ouch." And I looked, and he had an AK-47 round sticking in him like a dart.
Really?
Really.
Wow.
What had happened was that we had a poncho strung up, and as we later reconstructed this thing, is it was coming a downward trajectory, hit the poncho, which deflected it up into his shoulder.
Huh.
And I pulled the thing out, and it was still warm, and I gave it to him as a souvenir. And, of course, hopefully he got his Purple Heart out of that.
Right.
At least I put him in for the Purple Heart at that time.
Right.
So that was basically it. On the 20th, we were there in the defensive positions along the Mechon until the 27th. My records show the 27th. Mm-hmm. The official book that came out said the 28th of April,
mm-hmm.
When the 7th Battalion was ordered to go north to attempt to relieve a unit, Marine unit, which is still up there, to break through up to Dong Ha again, which is sort of a stupid thing to do with the bad guys all around.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to get into the vehicle. We got our gear packed, and when I received an order that Rice and I were to be pulled back. And the reason for this at that time, there was the whole concept of the advisory unit was being changed.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having advisors at battalion level, the advisors were going to be kept at the brigade or the comparable Marine, U.S. Marine unit would be the regimental level,
mm-hmm.
and then get parceled out as needed.
Mm-hmm.
And my point was, hey, you know, if we don't need them on a road march, when do we need them? And it was the comment came back, don't be such a wise ass to Bono, you will get aboard that jeep and head south.
Mm-hmm.
They sent a jeep up for Rice and myself. The 7th Battalion took off. I think I thought at that point I'd never see them again.
Right.
However, on the march up there, the battalion commander got hit. They got ambushed.
Mm-hmm.
And the battalion commander got a round through his lungs. The S3, who was riding in the advisor jeep, got hit in the legs, back, and head. Wounded seriously, but not dead, so there, but for a fluke, would have been myself and Rice.
Right.
When we they pulled us back down to the area then, I was there until such time as the, as I said, my rotation tour date was 10th May established. So I returned then to Saigon on the 2nd of May, and seems to me I got a hop down on a Army General's plane.
Mm-hmm.
Or the pilot even let me fly it for about 3 heartbeats.
Oh, really?
Because the general wasn't aboard.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I left. And, of course, before leaving, we got the word the battalion commander and the S3 were hit, so we went over to the local hospital and paid our condolences. And Captain Kim, at that time, the XO, was the guy that took over the battalion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How did you feel leaving this time? Was it different from the previous tour?
This time it was, thank God I'm out of here. Last time is that I didn't want to leave my people.
Right, right.
That was the difference between the two tours, and kept thinking, my God, is this history repeating itself? When we go from one April's full day, to in 72 to 10th September of 67, what, why always at the end of the tours?
Mm-hmm.
And that was more or less my thought at that time. I was happy to be going out. That is a definite true story.
Okay. What was it like when you flew out and knew you were leaving the war for good and you would not be going back?
Didn't know if I'd be going back.
Really?
And that was the thing. I'm thinking, normal rotation, 3 years in the States and I'd be back over here,
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
So you got no sense that the South Vietnamese were on the road to defeat?
No. Okay. None, in fact, just the opposite.
Okay.
Because at that time, that's when the Vietnamese Marines started their counteroffensive.
Right.
And just rolled back the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And they even had plans to invade North Vietnam at Vinh.
Mm-hmm.
And which was because they always wanted the Thinh Bac to march north,
mm-hmm.
To go make the amphibious assault up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I my thought was, hey, they're going to definitely hold them this time. The NVA are not going to come rolling on down and taking over everything. The resistance is stiffened.
Mm-hmm.
American air power is back in full swing. And, we had B-52 strikes coming in for us.
Right.
We were directing B-52 strikes,
mm-hmm.
where we wanted them, which was unheard of before.
Mm-hmm.
But this was just a full out-and-out, you want to mess with us, watch out, mm-hmm. type thing. And also the TOWS came in then with the to take care of the NVA tanks. In fact, its first TOW was employed then, ground-mounted at the time, but then
mm-hmm.
they later got them into the helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
So, the NVA and naval gunfire offshore just broke up columns of NVA tanks, just decimated them. So as long as they had the heavy fire support there, which I would, I thought would continue on forever, or how long forever can be, there was no way that the South Vietnamese were going to lose then.
Mm-hmm. What happened then? What do you think happened?
Well, what happened was the unpopular war. Congress eventually pulled the funds. The peace agreement, if you want to call it that,
mm-hmm.
was violated in numerous occasions by the NVA.
Mm-hmm.
They rolled again and took over the whole country.
Right. So the key to that was American air power and air support?
Well, the key to that was the American Congress at that time, with the anti-war movement in full swing then,
mm-hmm.
Acceding to the desires of that group politically while pulling the support and the money away from the South Vietnamese.
Right. How was that flight back for you? Do you remember how you felt?
Yeah, I do. We there were a couple other advisors on the same flight as myself, because once again, this was even though I had been, of all the advisors there, I'd been in country longer, but due to the cutback of personnel, they wanted to get new people in there, and as we were going out, other American Marines were coming in, to be advisors, at the brigade level, and which I didn't understand because I had the experience, but I wasn't about to argue about that one.
Right.
When we lifted off from Tonsonute, It was a, for me, a big relief thing. We managed to stow a few bottles of old loudmouth aboard.
Mm-hmm.
The captain at that point in time said, well, you know, you could have something to drink, and we had a whole row of us partying, the Marine advisors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was a totally different flight than the first time.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time I just come out of a battle with American Marines, second time just out of a battle with Vietnamese Marines, but mm-hmm. Both time a sense of, my God, I made it again. How did that happen?
Right, right. Go ahead.
No, that was just the difference between the first and the second.
Right.
Second tour, you know, first tour was I made it. The second tour was I made it again.
Right, right. Before we leave Vietnam completely, let me ask you some general questions.
Sure.
And this refers to both of your tours.
Okay.
You underwent some, you know, some very intense times there, obviously, and in a dangerous position, both tours. Did your religious beliefs change at all because of your experiences in Vietnam, or could you tell that they had changed during the time you were there or after?
I was brought up a Roman Catholic, as I said earlier in this interview. I had gone to Catholic school for the first 8th grades. To me, a priest had always been, you know, a marvelous man, and we had a chaplain with us in 326, who was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be out up at Quezon, not the south, but up at Quezon when we were more or less typical Marine type units. He would fly in on a resupply mission, say mass, and fly back out in the last resupply and give communion and absolution and the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
and be out in 10 minutes. And now that's my kind of mass. Another thing that he did was, and I don't know whether it was sixth sense on his sense or on his part or what,
mm-hmm.
prior to this tense or to the time we went up to Quang Tien, he flew out one time and he gave everybody in the company absolute absolution, which is, you know, all your sins are forgiven. I don't care what religion you are or anything like that.
Right.
And of course, during the time that happened and I lost all my Marines in first tour, there was no way that they could commit any sins because we were, except maybe a plot,
mm-hmm.
because we were never around anything else or doing anything else except moving in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant a lot.
Right.
Later, between tours, when the Catholic Church started supporting the anti-war movement, I was extremely disappointed and I fell away from the faith
mm-hmm.
completely.
Okay.
Completely. I would not go to church. Then there's the old cliche about there is a God, particularly in the foxhole. I can remember a couple of times saying, you know, if you ever let me out of this, I'll be a good boy. I'll never do that again. I'll mm-hmm. never do that again.
Mm-hmm.
My religious beliefs as far as the Catholic Church or Catholicism changed. My belief in God never changed.
Okay.
That there is one.
Okay. Okay.
That sort of answered the question?
Absolutely, sir.
Okay.
What role did entertainment play for you all? How did you kind of blow off steam?
Well, first
of all, you've described some of this.
Yeah, we never had a USO show.
Okay.
The blowing off steam were a series of small things. For instance, on the first tour, when we moved back into the field, we're setting it up at the Quezon. This is strictly its Quezon. I heard singing coming from one of my platoons, and there were a group of Marines down there who were quite good,
mm-hmm.
Who I named my songbirds. And, of course, the company commander next door, whose name I won't mention to me, mm-hmm. I was on a full tactical alert, ready for the NVA to come storming across. And he reported back to battalion that he hears singing coming from Mike Company's lines. So I would then have every evening, when we were back in from the field,
mm-hmm.
Which wasn't all too often, have them report up to my CP tent where we would go ahead and have a little sing fest by our songbirds.
What kind of songs would they sing?
You know, popular songs of the day, you know, and very well harmonized, a mixed group of black and white Americans that
mm-hmm.
just liked to sing.
Right.
Another way we blew off steam, we had a mess night.
Mm-hmm.
at Mike, and this is a sort of a formal affair. When we came back in from the field one time, Lieutenant Manzi, my 3rd platoon commander, who got killed on the 7th of September, got a whole package from home with salamis, spaghetti, and even managed to smuggle in a few bottles of wine, even though you're not supposed to do that. And so we invited the battalion commander and the battalion staff out to our place where we had a mess night with place cards in front of everybody, served spaghetti and wine. The small things like the troops, like I said, did not drink much alcohol. It was mostly soda pop. Back, once again, back from the field, the way the best thing was like taking a shower. They had a shower eventually established up at Quezon. We go down in company formation, go right through, drop our clothes at one end, go through the shower, and pick up clean clothes in the other end. And also the second time, which was totally different than first, and that was that we were back in Saigon, the Pearl of the Orient or whatever. The blowing off steam there was partying, and of course an occasional fisticuffs with members of the other armed forces who did not think, or and particularly civilians, who particularly foreign nationals.
Really?
We do not think it appropriate to stand for the Marines' hymn at our at the Kovan bar, so to speak. Little episodes like that, or going down with the flags to scrounge gear. In fact, when the Army division was pulling up out of when we were in Da Nang, I loaded up. Oh, gee whiz! It had to be 40 Connex boxes. Full of wall lockers, foot lockers, tables, chairs, things like that, to ship back to Saigon for the Vietnamese Marine base camps back there. So that was the way to blow off steam.
Okay. Were drugs or alcohol ever an issue with my company or any of the other units with which you served?
Drugs, definitely not. Okay. Alcohol, yeah, when, not on first tour.
Right.
Second tour, yeah, we would go back and we would get smashed upon occasion back in Saigon. And that was, like I say, a big party town. But as far as overindulgence or alcoholic type, no. There was no way, because you knew you were going to go back out in the field again.
Right.
When you went back out in the field, you would not have your alcoholic ability or ability to take alcohol with you. Well, the first tour, we got 2 beers a day. If lucky. Second tour, there was no no drinking at all, per se, except in the rear areas back in Saigon.
Okay. Andy, are there any songs that you hear on the radio today that, that take you back to Vietnam?
The only one is that I don't know, yeah, we got to get out of this place. I mean, that...
that's almost the universal answer.
Yeah. I don't even know what the name of it is, but I could sing it.
That's the name of it.
Yeah, okay. That to me was the whole anthem on the second tour. First tour, no songs that I remembered or anything particularly about that. But the second tour, yeah, that was definitely the song. In fact, after the Marines' hymn at this the watering hole called the Wabin, incidentally, it was the watering hole in Saigon. They had a piano player down there, and of course the rear area or the Marine station in Saigon, they made this the official home of the Kovans, and they had knew the piano player in there. And he'd play the Marines hymn, and then we got to get out of this place.
Back to back.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Did you keep up with news from back in the United States through your letters, or were you able to obtain Stars and Stripes or anything like that?
We first tour very rarely ever saw it.
Okay.
Second tour, same way. We were in a cocoon type as far as outside media went, although I did run into U.S. media on the second tour. For instance, one time the battalion was moving north along this road, and there was a cameraman out there, and I don't even know what network or whatever, and all the refugees were fleeing south, and you know, he was taking pictures of the refugees fleeing. I asked him, hey, what are you doing? He said, well, you know, I'm filming this for my new, and I, whatever. But anyhow, well, what are you doing? Well, I'm taking all the fleeing refugees and how bad things are. I said, hey, look on both sides of the road here. Look right up there and look behind me. You see this? These are Vietnamese Marines going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my news organization doesn't want that.
Hmm.
I took his camera and threw it in a rice paddy.
Did you really?
Oh, yes. I was in the media, difference between first tour and second tour media. The media on the second tour were just anything bad, that was news. Anything good was not. First tour, anything good and bad, but mostly new, slanted towards the good, was what got reported.
Okay. And why do you think there was that discrepancy, that big difference between the two tours?
Because of the situation, the perceived anti-war movement in the States, the we got rid of Lyndon, what's selling, this is selling, let's go film this rally over here against the war, no rallies for the war,
mm-hmm.
which are totally different than today, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Even in my small town of Ennis, Montana, they had an anti-war rally that attracted 5 people. Across the street were 250 supporting the war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just the current war now, but to know what was going on back there then, no.
Okay.
No.
Did it affect morale at all?
Never affected mine.
Okay.
You know, I've heard stories about people getting spit upon, and you know, and things like this. Never happened to me. I'm not saying it didn't happen to them.
Right.
But it never happened to me. And I probably would have reacted very adversely had it
mm-hmm.
happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
But the baby killer or things of this, no. Okay. I never had anything like that. And the second tour now, you have to remember, too, we had 35 officers and I think 14 enlisted as a TO strength of the advisory unit.
Mm-hmm.
And all the advisors, every single one of them, had at least one combat tour in Vietnam
mm-hmm.
prior to going over for their second tour. And the reason why they were there is because they wanted to be there. They had also the same option that I initially had. Well, I could go to division on Okinawa
mm-hmm.
or go in-country to an advisory unit if they were good.
Mm-hmm.
And they were more or less hand-picked type people. As a matter of fact, out of the people, the 35 people that I had with me in-country, 6 of them later made general officer.
Wow.
And that is an unheard of statistic
mm-hmm.
when you take a random group, if you will, of 35 officers to have that many
mm-hmm.
make general officer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But no, as far as the effect on my morale or the effect on the morale of the people that I saw, either tour, I saw no adverse effects.
Okay.
More of an adverse effect would be, of course, when they got first tour, when they got a Dear John letter, or
right.
something of that. That was the bad news.
Right, right. In your units, did you all ever have any pets?
No.
Okay.
Well, the first platoon adopted a dog one time,
mm-hmm.
but the dog moved out, and I didn't know whatever happened to the dog, but it just went by the wayside.
Okay.
But as far as pets go, for any period of time, no.
Okay.
No pets.
How about any experience with the wildlife there in Vietnam, from scorpions, snakes, ants, to tigers, elephants?
One time we called in a fire mission on 3 deer when we were up in near the DMZ with my mortars and went out to check the effect, and we didn't get any.
Mm-hmm.
Another time, my LP heard people farting in front of them, so they threw 3 hand grenades out, and we had a roast pig the next day.
Huh.
All the snakes, we saw snakes, any number of snakes there, and the word was every snake you saw is a poisonous snake.
Mm-hmm.
But I never had anyone, with the exception of Lieutenant Colonel Nya, in the second tour, who got a snake bite,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sort of suspicious of that. I never had any of my troops bit by a snake, saw a tiger. We saw prints up
mm-hmm.
at Khe Sanh,
mm-hmm.
but we never actually physically ran into any of the wildlife per se.
Okay, okay. In your units, especially on your first tour, and then I guess on your second tour as well, interacting with the Vietnamese, were there any race issues that you witnessed?
No. No, particularly in the first tour. I mean, the
mm-hmm.
race The only time I witnessed any race issues were not with Marines. They were with the another branch of the service, specifically the Army, who were in the rear areas, not the combat troops out on the line. I could not talk to them because neither tour did I go out there. But for instance, when I go with the firing batteries who were supporting us from Camp Carroll, I went up there and personally thanked them for their great work with artillery and the whole thing like that. And but the black community, if you will, in the rear areas seemed to, particularly in the Saigon area, when you'd see one, you'd see 15 of them. They were not integrated at all in the Saigon area. But once again, these were enlisted, me being an officer then, never had any problem with them as a group or them as a individuals.
Okay. Were you ever exposed to your knowledge, Agent Orange or any of the other defoliants?
There's little doubt that I was both tours, because if you look at the areas where they defoliated, I operated through there. I drank that water sometimes without halazone pills because we were so thirsty. Yeah, I was probably in both tours exposed.
Any effects?
Not discernible, not not according to the VA. I got cancer at a rather unusual type, being testicular, which is a young man's disease, which is why I retired from the Marine Corps. Nothing that the VA recognizes as
okay.
far as effects, nor do I think any effects that I could see on myself.
Okay. Okay. Andy, looking back at both tours, are there any particularly brave incidents that come to mind that you witnessed?
Boy. Boy, where do you want me to start? Jeez. My gunny sergeant. With 16 holes in him. We're getting overrun on the first tour, and he is out there just shooting and moving around and everything like that. My squad leaders, after their lieutenants and platoon commanders get killed, they're in there kicking ass, taking names of their troops, making sure they're laying down the base of fire. Their Marines are still going, and they are just so gung-ho and just... my gunnery sergeant, a guy by the name of Gleason, incidentally, due to my rapid leaving from Vietnam, my first tour, and that I got doctor, I eventually got him a Silver Star, which was awarded in 2001, and I was there. I got one of my squad leaders another Silver Star, who was pinned down in his bomb crater, and he carried another wounded Marine in there by the name of Frank Taggart. They had 23 bodies stacked in front of them. The second tour, there was a, not that I witnessed personally, but I heard of a Vietnamese sergeant who got up with the law as the NVA tanks were starting to roll across the bridge of Dong Ha, who fired the first law miss, second one hit the tank, did not disable it, but the tank backed up and giving a guy by the name of John Ripley, captain at the time, time to blow up the bridge of Dong Ha. The like I say, you know, I could go on and on and on. The ambushes that we'd set up along the side, the kid who got the butt stroke to the back of the head, and while his buddy then killed the other guy along there, running down NVA prisoners, I mean NVA and VC troops who were crawling through the bush and jumping on top of them, you know, to make to capture instead of kill them, because I would give an R&R for that. I mean, in a line unit, it was just so damn numerous. My lieutenant got killed. Well, both lieutenants got killed. When their lines came under, they were the first guy over there stemming the thing. On the 7th of September, Manji got killed. On 10th of September, Gall, 2nd Lieutenant Gall, and 2nd Lieutenant Gaeton. And I remember Gaeton running by me saying, hey, I have to go find my lieutenant. And the lieutenant's already dead, and Gaeton got killed also. I mean, it's just so many. Just so many. as far as the bad guys, you know, making that frontal assault in daylight, I don't know how they would ever do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just indescribable going into that. Perhaps they thought they only had one company out there dealing with. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could go on and on and on. It's just, it's amazing
mm-hmm.
what the American fighting man can do.
Mm-hmm. Conversely, on another topic, any particularly humorous incidents that come to mind when you think of your two tours?
You know, those are the ones you tend to concentrate on, the humorous ones. For instance, I think I related one before about the pig incident, where the listening post reported somebody farting in front of their lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so the radio operator woke me up and I talked to him. I said, well, what is it? He said, well, don't know, sir. They're farting in front of my lines. And I had a SOP, you do not shoot your weapon.
Mm-hmm.
What you would do, you would throw hand grenades. So I told him, hey, next time you hear them farting, throw the hand grenades at them, alert the lines, and then come on back in.
Mm-hmm.
Short story long, they threw the hand grenades, maybe about 10 minutes later, came running on back in, went out the next day and found the pig. The mess night incident that I relayed about that, we also used to have, when we were outside the lines, I did not like unannounced visitors coming into my line, so the gunny, same gunny Norris, my other gunny had gotten killed on the 17th of July in Quezon, we set out a little radio watch out there,
mm-hmm.
and that was our rear security. And they would not allow it into my company's position, and even the battalion commander got stopped upon occasion.
Mm-hmm.
But he tried to come out and see us. Radio. There's always these reports that you had to give, like enemy equipment, and we'd always try to make a joke out of it. For instance, one time we found the NVA paymaster. And he had a couple bottles of, I guess, of the Vietnamese whiskey with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we report that we got the paymaster with X number of dong and two bottles of booze, which are currently leaking, so therefore they have to be consumed on the spot. And any time that I could, I attempted to inject a little bit of humor into the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Or when I would be talking to my Marines, you know, particularly after a brutal firefight or something of that nature, you know. And you could see them still, you know, with the look in their eyes, and I'd attempt to kid them out of it. Humorous, I mean, once again, that's what that's the things I tended to look at, not
mm-hmm.
the other part.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you think of Vietnam itself, the country?
A gorgeous country, inland, along the... coastal area where the majority of the population was. It was a very industrious type country. The people themselves are very industrious.
Mm-hmm.
The political leadership, definite has and has nots in that. But I enjoyed the country. In fact, you know, like in Quezon with the waterfalls and the gorgeous mountains, I mean, it was a beautiful country.
Mm-hmm. What about Vietnamese civilians?
The civilians, once again, we had very few interactions with on first tour
mm-hmm.
Because we very rarely saw civilians, except when we were on motor marches. And the second tour with the Vietnamese Marines, of course, I would see their family. I would see the people in Saigon, see the cowboys down there. And, of course, in any society, there's that element of the no-gooders.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the ones that they're primarily exposed to. As far as getting out into the villages and things like that,
mm-hmm.
the only time we'd get out there is to move them out, because that's when the resettling thing came again, and that was not a happy occasion. I can
mm-hmm.
imagine moving away from my ancestral land and moving into a base where I'm crammed together with a bunch of other people with... And they were very stoic in a sense,
mm-hmm.
And very able to survive, very survivable people, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you think of the American body count policy?
The American what policy again?
Body count.
I'm sorry.
The body count policy.
Oh, body count.
Mm-hmm.
body count was a bunch of BS. It was an attempt to quantify a war where there was no quantification available. In other words, if 10 of them got killed and you lost one, that was a great battle. That was a bunch of BS, because if I lost one Marine, it was one too many.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really give a hoot about body count. But I, particularly on first tour, I was continually harassed. You want a body count? I'll give you a body count. You know, one arm, two legs, and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And my personal way of thinking about it, I once again, it was attempting to quantify something that was not quantifiable.
Okay.
Because even with the body count, if it was a war of attrition, if that was our concept, and that was the big military concept, I guess, that we will eventually get them with firepower, but we left the people alone then, and there were two different ideas. There was the Army idea and the Marine Corps idea.
Mm-hmm.
The Marine Corps idea was to go ahead and pacify the villages of the inkblots, move them out. The Army idea was to go out with the massive formations, have them attack you and destroy them. But yet, for instance, on the 10th of September, we found two regiments of NVA.
Mm-hmm.
There's little doubt that we found two regiments of NVA.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't go after them. In fact, the unit that relieved us, 2-4, 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, got up there, and 2 weeks later, they were overrun, including their CP.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the bad guys were there. What happened to this preponderance of force? What happened to this, we're going to find them and fix them? They were there,
mm-hmm.
and we never went after them. And I guess that's strange slightly from the body count theory, but that, to answer your question about body count, mm-hmm. is a bunch of BS.
Okay. When you came home from your second tour, did you have the same experience as you did the first tour, that people weren't really asking questions about what you had done?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the same basic thing, because once again, after coming home from the second tour, I was assigned as the S3 of the 3rd, initially the 1st Battalion, 7th Marines, and then the battalion changed its designation to 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines.
Okay.
So I just went, and then the wife and family were in California, and I wanted to stay there because of the school situation, so I was immediately, so then my monitor assigned me to division at that time.
Okay.
As a major.
Did you have any difficulty the second time around transitioning to stateside life?
No, none whatsoever.
Okay.
Reason being, immediately picked up a more intense environment. That was the time that the way I like to call it, the fruits of the people that I put in the Marine Corps,
mm-hmm.
Were coming to full term in the Marine Corps, and that the UA rate in a unit would be something like 25-30% of them would be gone over the hill.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the things that happened with the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, we were assigned a troop test by Headquarters Marine Corps,
mm-hmm.
and we eventually got down to zero UAs in the battalion, which was unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
But the tempo that it was picked up immediately, I had no time really to think of anything else.
Okay. Did you keep up with what was happening over in Vietnam?
Yes, somewhat, because I always thought that since we, by virtue of this troop test, if in fact there ever was, even though with the 3rd Marine Division in Okinawa, we would be one of the first units to mount out of Camp Pendleton, because we were, in fact, with the exception of strength, missing our 4th Rifle Company,
mm-hmm.
We were the go unit.
Right. How did you feel when the United States finally pulled out in 73?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
How did you feel in 73 when the United States finally officially withdrew from South Vietnam?
At the time, I thought, okay, it's a political decision. Those with more knowledge than myself, particularly with the peace accords that were signed at the time,
mm-hmm.
The promises made by politician to politician, the pact signed, I thought, well, that's the resolution of that conflict.
Mm-hmm.
The country did not necessarily go back to the status quo, and that the NVA had a portion of Northern I Corps, because that's where their advance ended and the South Vietnamese, that's as far as they pushed them back.
Mm-hmm.
The imperial capital of Hue, where the Vietnamese took that, what was left of it, was a big rallying point for the Vietnamese Marines. And my thought at that time, okay, we left, but we left at least leaving the country intact.
Right. Was peace with honor achieved?
Oh, was it achieved? Obviously not.
Okay.
Was that a good term? Yeah, at that time it was a good term because of all the concessions that had been made by both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Although the South Vietnamese did not like the peace treaty that was signed, at least it was a peace treaty, and at least there was a promise of no further aggression by the North.
Right. How did you feel in April 1975 when Saigon fell and South Vietnam fell?
Unbelievable. During this period of time, I was then going to college, getting my college degree, and it was sort of a liberal college, and there was little doubt that I was a Marine there,
mm-hmm.
but I did not, you know, I was sort of glued to the TV set watching this and reading the news on it and seeing what happened with the Andamiguez incident around the same period of time.
Mm-hmm.
It was just unbelievable. My thing is that I felt that my country had left the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese in the lurch, did not back up the peace treaty that was signed, and to me this was inconceivable.
Okay. Could you make any comments about U.S. policy overall in the Vietnam War? What are your thoughts and feelings about that today?
I wonder if there was any policy. And as far as that goes, what was the end game? What was the what was actually expected to be accomplished? As I mentioned earlier, there were two schools of thought, the Army and the Marine Corps school of thought, on how to conduct warfare over there.
Mm-hmm.
By virtue of the commander in the area being an Army guy, the Army view prevailed, and the Marines, who he continually chastised by not getting enough units out in the field or making enough contacts or whatever, not enough big battles, so to speak, or battalion or size. The policy that the Marines had about the cap groups, the squad of Marines going in, actually living in a unit or living in a village, training the Vietnamese local forces there,
mm-hmm.
South Vietnamese, which was a great policy, never adhered to by the Army. As far as the, and it's the same thing time after time that we should have learned from Vietnam historically, that there has to be an exit strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there appears to be no exit strategy. There appears to be, in my mind, no clear goal, no clear defining thing in Vietnam. Just like the tactics, the NVA would fight a unit near the DMZ, demilitarized zone, right. They'd go back across. I would see boat traffic. I would see NVA formations on the other side of the river from Con Tien.
Mm-hmm.
I could not shoot at them because mm-hmm. they were in North Vietnam, and I could not fire my artillery, my naval gunfire, into North Vietnam. We could bomb them.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't do that as a guy on the ground. Into Laos when Lam Son 719.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they found all sorts of stuff over there. And then the incursion into Cambodia,
mm-hmm.
which all there the U.S. is going to go ahead and invade another country. And all that did was fuel the anti-war media.
Mm-hmm.
There was no policy in my estimation. When it went in with good intentions, like saving the government, how do you do that? there was no answer.
Do you think the United States learned any lessons from its experience in Southeast Asia?
I know militarily that we learned a number of lessons. For instance, during the Gulf War, I personally knew in the Marine side, there was Walt Boomer, who was a three-star general, who was an advisor there.
Mm-hmm.
There's Larry Livingston, who later made two-star. He was one of the regimental commanders, Marines. There was Bill Keyes, who commanded one of the divisions over there, a two-star general at the time. He was an advisor there.
Mm-hmm.
There was Adams, who at the time was a captain there and had a regiment and later retired as a two-star general. The military learned a lot from Vietnam, particularly the effects of artillery,
mm-hmm.
and that was one of the primary things that learned during the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
Politically, did we learn anything? I hesitate to say so. If you look at today's quagmire again, and it's being compared to Vietnam, but there is no comparison. Vietnam was a one-time, one-situational type thing that went awry. While the exit strategy is the biggest thing, while we had the people, for instance, World War II in Germany and Japan,
mm-hmm.
We were able to, if you will, turn those countries around into a democracy, into our image. We are fighting a totally different type of people
mm-hmm.
Today who are religiously bent fanatics as opposed to nationalists bent fanatics.
Mm-hmm.
So did we learn anything? Military, yes. I don't see what we learned from Vietnam per se politically, except you need the support of the media at all times, which is a great idea with the embedding of reporters
mm-hmm.
That came up. So therefore, the media got to see what really happened instead of what was reported to have happened.
Right, right. Let's talk about your personal experience in Vietnam during your two tours. How do you feel about it today?
Oh, I'm proud. Would I do it again? Yeah. Would I do it the same exact way? Most of the time, some things I would change with if I knew what I knew now, what I knew then, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I'm extremely proud of my Vietnam service. I was put to the test as a Marine, and I acquitted myself, in my opinion, in the opinion of my peers and my seniors and juniors, I acquitted myself quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Not only virtue of the combat decorations, but also the innovations that I did during the time that were later carried out, in some cases, Marine Corps-wide.
Mm-hmm. What do you think was the most significant thing that you learned while you were there?
Probably more about myself. Who am I really? And that was the biggest important thing to me. Who is Andy DeBona?
What did you learn?
I learned that I am extremely capable. I learned that I am adaptable. I learned that my instincts are extremely good. I learned that my awareness, my physical and mental awareness, were exceptional, and that I would be able to almost sense when something was about to happen, or I would be able to have a plan already formulated, and as soon as the first cap got busted, boom, we'd immediately do things in what later proved to be the right way. The right way in that I would take minimum casualties, all the bad guys, we would make sure that they never shot at us again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do you think the war has most affected your life?
Probably that I am a lot more capable. My capabilities, I felt that it increased substantially. I was not afraid to try new things or do new things. Even though the stereotype of a Marine is yes sir, no sir, nine bags full sir,
mm-hmm.
To me it was never that way. I tried new things. Even today, for instance, we have a Veterans Memorial here in town that I have raised $140,000 for, and it's one of the nicest memorials that you have in four states around here.
Mm-hmm.
My abilities, there is no limit to my capabilities or abilities, but I can do just about anything that I set my mind to.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of self-confidence involved, I believe would be a good word for it.
Okay. Do you read books about Vietnam, go see movies about Vietnam?
Oh, I continually read, well, not only about Vietnam, about that's one of my pastimes. I'm an avid reader. I'll normally, when we're south in the desert, I will probably read a book every other day down there. Mm-hmm. Do I specifically pick Vietnam topics? If there is a book who I consider to be a good author, and I will read that historical type. I continue to read books about Vietnam. There are some things, of course, yeah, particularly what I didn't know, the high-level type stuff, and to find out the actual why. Why did we do this? Mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes there is no answer. Most of the time there is no answer, except some politician saying, because I said so.
Right. How about movies?
Movies, I seen the movies on Vietnam, and I think I've seen Full Metal Jacket and Acropolis Now. Just a total, unbelievable distortion of what Vietnam was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a... The movie that I did see, two movies, as a matter of fact, that I consider to be probably the most realistic and the most heart-rending to me were Patton and Saving Private Ryan.
Okay.
None about Vietnam. But there is, I don't think there has been a true movie called Green Beret with John Wayne. I saw that one. But once again, totally, unequivocally, the worst bit of portrayal of Vietnam. And in fact, there hasn't been one that has portrayed Vietnam as I knew it.
Okay. That first half of Full Metal Jacket, do you remember that? That was all about Paris Island?
Do I? Yes.
Was it accurate at all to you?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, having been through recruit training, having commanded a recruit training battalion at the time, that was plain and unadulterated horseshit.
Well, was it harsher than that? Was it more difficult, or what was so different?
Oh, the difference was, you know, that things like that would have never happened. Never happened that the guy would have a round from the range.
Right.
But never happened that the drill instructors, after McEwen incident had happened in 1958 when I worked in the brig at Paris Island, we had him in. This is the guy that marched the Marines through the swamp and had four of them killed in training, and almost the demise of the Marine Corps. Since that period of time, you're not allowed to swear. You cannot swear at the recruits. There's no physical contact with the recruits. I mean, it's a total concept of, and then that might be a stereotype of what recruit training was, perhaps. But even in '55, when I went through, there was nothing like that.
Right.
So it was just a complete distortion of the Marine Corps recruit training.
Okay. Do you suffer any disabilities from your service, including PTSD, anything like that?
No, I don't have that. I have a gunshot wound to the leg, and I have my cancer was associated with a disability, but not necessarily Vietnam.
Okay. What do you think about Vietnam today and what's going on between the countries? And would you want to go back to visit?
I have thought upon occasions about going back to visit. I would like to take my wife there, perhaps, you know, to see the... I've talked to any number of people who have been there. What's going on today is it's a vast market, if you will, for business, and American business is starting to get into the act because the French and the others have already been there. And there is a vast market there. It is a communist country, still very authoritative from the people I've talked to who have been there. They've brought back film, which I've seen. I've seen Case on. I would like to, if I could, without going through a formal tour, I would like to go back there and take a tour of my own. However, I don't want to go up and see Ho Chi Minh's memorial, nor do I want to go see the people's collection of the American bandits or American pirates type things where they shot down the airplanes and things of that nature.
Right. Andy, what do you think are the biggest myths and or misconceptions about the Vietnam veteran?
that he is a bum. He's the guy that has the sign out on the road, Vietnam vet will work for food, that he's the guy with the long hair and the peace symbol around his neck, running around in a parts of a uniform, who is either high on drugs or drunk. And that is so prevalent in our society, you know, and some, particularly the wannabes, the phonies, some of them aren't even veterans.
Mm-hmm.
We had a, I hosted my 3rd Battalion, 26th Marine reunion here in Ennis. We had 268 people show up. For those, 115 of them were Marines. The one thing they had in common, probably 70% of them had a Purple Heart.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing they did not have in common, we had maybe two of them in that mold of the, I'm the Vietnam veteran with the long hair and now,
mm-hmm.
and I still this and I'm still that. And these, one of them was a, happened to be a captain at the time who I don't think ever had a shot fired in anger, but he's now a war veteran. And another one was one of the enlisted Marines. He wasn't in my company. He was in another company. But those are about the only typical, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Type perception of the Vietnam vet. The other ones were presidents of their company, firemen, insurance executives, I mean, successful businessmen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the story that doesn't get told.
Right. Do you think the U.S. government has taken care of the Vietnam veterans?
In a sense, to a fault, particularly on this PTSD,
mm-hmm.
There's a book out called Stolen Valor. I don't know whether you're familiar with it or
not. Yes, sir, I am.
Where they, Beckett, I think the guy's name was.
Burkett.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Went through and the PTSD syndrome type thing. They're actually, they hold classes on that. And, you know, the people that he found in it, the stories they related did not actually jive with the incidents that happened on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Like one an example, one guy's a cook, yet he describes going out there on patrol and killing any number of bad people and, you know, seeing all that blood and gore.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a break. The PTSD thing, it exists, I'm sure, but not to the magnitude, and the government does not check into that.
Mm-hmm.
Do they take care of the other Vietnam vets? I don't think that they don't need to take care of the Vietnam vets, per
mm-hmm.
se.
Mm-hmm.
They should be self-reliant. They should be self-sufficient. You had a career type of guy stay in, hey, you know, it was a, if they were honorable, if they did their job, they were rewarded for promotion. For instance, I told you the story about all the general officers of the Mao.
Mm-hmm.
They're in there. The others made it on up through. There were some who weren't honorable, who didn't make it, nor should they have made it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think the government owes the Vietnam veteran anything more than it owes any other veteran from Korea, from World War II,
mm-hmm.
or from anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
The owes thing is a, I don't like that word.
Okay.
Or is the government taking care of them? The government should not have to take care of anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone should be self-sufficient.
Okay. Okay. Have you ever been to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington?
Once.
Can you describe your experience there?
It was, very humbling. And I went with a friend of mine, which is the only way I'd go, but I will never go back.
Mm-hmm.
Too many names.
Were you all there during the night or during the day?
We went during the day. I don't think I could handle the night.
Uh-huh.
Bad enough during the day. I've never seen the moving walls that came around.
Do you purposely not go to see them?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, purposely not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one likes to go back. I think, you know, my philosophy is to look forward, and or today, or to look forward, don't go back, but it's difficult not to go back.
Mm-hmm.
Even though some of the memories are, you know, are extremely good, others are extremely bad.
Yes, sir. Were you able to find some of the names of the soldiers who served under you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you think the memorial is an appropriate memorial?
Appropriate. It's a recognition of those who have given their life in a a war that was not supported in the end by too many people, but I don't think any memorial could be appropriate to what they gave and what was expected of them.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as appropriate, no memorial would ever be appropriate.
Okay. Would you ever want to go back to the wall?
No.
Okay. Andy, what would you tell the younger generations today about Vietnam if you had a chance to address a high school classroom or a college classroom?
Well, as a matter of fact, I do. We have our local high school. When they study that aspect of American history, there's a retired Marine gunny sergeant out of the reserves from Recon. What I tell them is, you know, I first of all read over their book and what the book says about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And the book was written, in my opinion, by liberal historians who put their own slant or their own bent on that and the unjustness or whatever. And I just explained to them what I saw with the people. The people voted with their feet initially by not wanting to stay in North Vietnam. There was an issue of North Vietnam never giving up their desire to conquer the South. The stories, for instance, of My Lai, which made the news, that nothing was ever mentioned about the 3,000 civilians killed during Tet of 68. Yeah, the political leaders of that time micromanaged something that it was not in their, should have not have been in their hands. It should have been in the hands of the military. The different slants, if you will, like the Vietnam veteran, you know, who he is, and look at me. And then I answer questions. And the questions go, well, what was it like to be shot at? You know, not nice.
Right.
I'm being facetious about that, you know. But you know, I kind of tell you that you learned a lot about yourself. Did you ever kill anyone? Yes, and I'd let's drop that. You know, I mean, from any range of questions, from my perspective, from the perspective of someone who's been there, done that, as opposed to a book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. And is there anything else that you'd like to discuss that we have not discussed during our interview?
Oh, no, not really, except, you know, there was an after Vietnam where I...
Absolutely.
Yeah, where I went, the Marine Corps said I get a college education because I had never... I'd been going when I could to off-duty education, and I went to university where I got a BA and an MA at the same time. I eventually had another opportunity when I was assigned to a sort of a staff-type job where I got an MBA, sent to Army Command and General Staff School at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, where I picked up an MMS. So education became very important to me at, during this period of time, primarily because I think of the maturity. And that's one thing I tell the kids, too, about education. I said, you don't realize the opportunities you have to further your education. You know, some of you are just marking time here, ready to, you know, go out and conquer the world, but you're not going to conquer the world unless you have an education. And that was it. After Vietnam, of course, you always continually run into the camaraderie. Even today, as I said, I just heard from Frog Leg Brabham day before yesterday. Bald Boomer calls periodically. Billy Keyes calls. And, you know, it's and we do have our reunions, which, you know, and it's not a time to get sit down and reflect on war stories. It's a time to go see, hey, you know, how are you doing? What's happening with you now? Where are you going in the future?
And you served honorably with the Marine Corps until 1981.
That's correct. That's when I had cancer with 6 months, 2 years to live.
You're alive and kicking for sure now.
Well, I'd like to say about my eighth one.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add, sir?
That's all, except thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to discuss this with you, Richard. And, look forward to seeing the typed version when it comes in.
Yes, sir. Well, it's been our pleasure and honor to talk with you. This will end the oral history interview with Andrew DeBona. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Richard.